This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com. The only place to be in your pop culture world.
Come on, Elizabeth. Come on. We call it the place to be.
Yes, it's the place to be.
Then I shall be.
Place to Be Nation, Scott Criscola and Justin Rosero. This is the Place to Be podcast.
It is contagious. It is the place to be, and we are live each and every Monday.
To do worse than Josh Richter.
Get down a size. Don't do me like that.
Place to Be Nation! Welcome back to the great episode of the one and only Place to Be podcast. I am your co-host, Justin Zero, coming at you live here on this Monday evening. And Scott Criscola, sir, it has been a while, and as usual, when we take like a week off, all hell breaks loose and a lot goes down. And it's actually been 2 weeks since we last spoke and recorded, and we do have things to cover, sir, things to cover. How are you?
We do. Good evening, JR. Good evening, Place to Be Nation. Welcome to 465 of the longest-running, continuous, episodic Gold Standard. Yeah. The 2 weeks has been... Forget, like, pipe bombs and stuff. Yeah. This is ludicrous what has happened in the 2 weeks since you and I have actually spoken.
Yeah, the Mets got eliminated from playoff contention. Well, that happened when we took our break in May.
Yeah. That happened before St. Mary's. What are you talking about?
All right, well, before we do get to some of these topics, why don't I go ahead and bring in the third man who, you know, we're in sync, me and Kelly Nelson. You know, we're feeling it. We're on the same wavelength because even though we both took completely separate vacations at the same exact time, we were both in cities called Naples. He was in Naples, Italy. I was in Naples, Florida. This is how in sync we are, my brother, Kelly Nelson. How are you, sir?
I'm doing great. It's great to be back here. And it's going to be a big show tonight, boys.
A lot on tap. We are, of course, covering the January 87 Saturday Night's Main Event. We'll do that in a bit. We have to do our 1986 year in review. We'll get to that in a moment. And we also have to pay tribute to one of the greatest professional wrestlers slash managers of all time, because we haven't spoken since that happened. But other news broke today that we should talk about in the world of entertainment, the world of music, and that's Tom Petty suffered a cardiac arrest. He was found unconscious, brought to the hospital, and word leaked out shortly after that he had been taken off life support and passed away. And then clarifications came out that he was not yet passed away. He was still on life support. I believe as the time that we're recording this, he is still on life support, so he's not passed away yet. It sounds like he's kind of in a vegetative state, that he has no brain activity. So for all intents and purposes, he's probably not going to be with us much longer. So we thought we'd talk about it for a minute. I like Tom Petty. I like a lot of his music. I can't say I'm like a huge fan or super knowledgeable about him. So that's where I turn to my pop culture guru, the man who's seen all of music since the 20s, and that is Scott. Scott, why don't you talk about Tom Petty and we'll get Kelly's thoughts.
The 1812 The 1812 Overture?
Do, do, do,
no.
Go ahead.
Yes. Tom Petty from Gainesville, Florida. So he's probably a big Gators fan. One of the greatest rock musicians of the past 35 years. Obviously, I like more of his stuff in his early years when he was a heartbreaker. Tom Petty and the Heartbreakers had some great albums through the years. A lot of songs. A lot of people would know in movies like American Girl was in a movie, The Waiting, Refugee came out in the late 70s, early 80s.
The song you heard to open the show, Don't Do Me Like That, was in It's Complicated, the greatest movie of the 2000s.
That is correct. And then, You Got Lucky, which is the music video where they're like cowboys and they walk into the arcade with all the wrapped up arcade games, which is one of my favorite videos, actually. What else? One of JR's favorite Tom Petty songs, Free Fallin', because it reminds him of the 2007 Patriots.
The official theme song of them choking away a perfect season, yes.
That's right. and then, of course, he went on his – he kind of went solo after that, and Full Moon River came out, which is a great album, and and he's been pretty much solo ever since. I think he had maybe one or two heartbreakers.
He's still touring. He played the Hollywood Bowl a few days ago, I read. So he was still going strong.
Yep. And, Ballad of Mary Jane. And what's the other song that's got the song I like? It's got Johnny Depp in the video. What the heck is it called?
Is it the Alice in Wonderland one? Don't Come Around Here No More?
Well, that's Don't Come Around Here No More. No, but I'm thinking that's a good song, too. But I'm thinking of another one. It's kind of like goes kind of like Bad Company's Shooting Star, where it's this guy that goes into L.A. and he wants to be I can't think of the name of the song. Anyway, Faye Dunaway's in the video. Anyway, it's another great song. But tremendous musician.
Running Down a Dream was the great Bret Hart music video, if you remember, back in 92-ish, I think. 92,
that's right, yeah. Yep. So, sadly, I mean, obviously, even if he lives, he's not going to really probably be functioning. So, at 66 years old, a sad, on top of what has already been a terrible day, mm-hmm. with obviously what happened in Vegas, which was an abomination. This, on top of it, just, makes us all realize mortality. But 66 years old, Tom Petty, and one of the greatest musicians, had his own channel.
Still does.
On Sirius XM. Yep. He has I don't know if he has his own channel or if he has a show.
No, it's his own channel? Channel 31. I put it on the way home today. I was listening to it for a little bit.
Yeah, and he also has an extra show on, I think it's Deep Tracks. I think he has an extra show. Tom Petty's Buried Treasures, too. They do a show on Deep Tracks. Sad, very sad. Another great news. I mean, for those that listen to the podcast back in January that myself, Mr. Greenhouse, and Mr. D'Amato did, eulogizing the great musicians of 2016. Sadly, we will probably have a pretty meaty eulogy podcast at the end of this year as well. And Tom Petty will definitely talk about it. So, Kel, big Petty guy up in the great north there?
No, I'm sort of like JR. I like a lot of his songs, but I've never been a huge fan. And I was going to mention the Bret Hart video. Mm-hmm. Was it Running Down a Dream or was it Making Some Noise? That's what I'm.
Oh, maybe it was Making Some Noise. Yeah, I think you're right.
That's what I got here on.
Yeah, you're right. Yep.
Yeah. So there's the wrestling connection. But yeah, no, a very well-respected musician, hugely popular. I'm kind of, an outlier when it comes to Tom Petty, because it seems like most people I know have much more appreciation for him than I do. So it's very sad that he's probably not going to make it.
A really strong Super Bowl act too in that year. With that, I mean, beyond just the Schadenfreude of the Schadenfreude.
What year was that one?
He played. That was the year the Pats Giants. That was why Free Fallin
was that the one.
Yeah, he played that one. Yeah, he was good. That's right. He was really good.
I thought it was Madonna, but she did the second Pats Giants Super Bowl. That's right.
Madonna, yeah, he definitely did the first one. He did the undefeated season one for sure.
Yep.
So yeah, no, he was really good. I feel like he broke a string of shaky ones. Right? Oh no, well, I guess Prince was the year before. Right?
Prince's was one of my favorite.
Yeah, Prince was great
because awesome. He sang "Purple Rain" in the rain.
Well, yeah, and they went to the run of older people after the Justin Timberlake, Janet Jackson thing scared everyone. Yes. So they went to all the safe artists.
They had that, and then the year before they had that or 2 years before, I guess. They had that Aerosmith, Britney Spears debacle before. I think that was the Bucks Raiders Super Bowl. That halftime was pretty. And I love Aerosmith, but that halftime was pretty hideous.
Yeah, they went to the run. They did Petty. They did Prince. They did was the Rolling Stones did one or something? Wasn't it them?
Stones did one. Yeah. The Who did one. Yeah. U2 did one the year after 9/11. I remember that because they did the list of all the names.
Stupid, beautiful day, Patriots.
Yeah, that's right. I think of Triple H is much better.
God.
Yeah, and hey, you walked into that one. Yeah, and then we've had some good ones the last, I guess, few years. But anyway, so Tom Petty right now.
This year, so.
That's right. So 66 years old, very sad. Tom Petty, one of the greatest artists of all time. And of course, also sadly, one of the greatest wrestlers and managers of our time also passed away over the last few weeks. How old was he? 72. Was he in his 70s? 72.
72.
A guy who pretty much dominates this podcast now with our refreshes. That, of course,
big night tonight.
Bobby the Brain.
Big
night tonight. Huge night tonight, yeah. It was kind of sad watching it today. Bobby the Brain Heenan, one of the greatest, if not the greatest manager of all time. And I applaud the WWE Network because I thought they were going to stick a lot of newer not junk, but a lot of newer stuff that we already know about, prime times and all that. I'm glad that they really put a nice hunk of AWA in there, because I think his his run managing Bockwinkle is just so underappreciated. I mean, the guy managed a world champion, and all we talk about some newer fans is that he, you know, one failing heel after another, but he was Bockwinkle's guy, and I was very I was very happy to see that, but that was a very sad day. And I met Bobby once a few years ago at a convention, and by that point he had no jaw left, so we didn't talk, and it was sad. It was unfortunate.
Yeah, I saw him at WrestleCon this year. He was there. No, it is very sad. It's tragic in a way that he was one of the greatest talkers in wrestling history. You know, was rendered unable to talk for like the last whatever how many years of his life. And it makes you wonder how much we got robbed of. I mean, I guess he was. I mean, he was kind of sick when he was on good terms, but you wonder if he was in full health coming out of like WrestleMania 17 and into 02 or 03. I think they probably would have done more with him, because it was after that time they brought back Mean Gene to do Confidential, and you feel like Heenan would have been a guy on a lot of these, and he's on some stuff, but you feel like he would have been much more active. And I feel like we probably got robbed a lot about, you know, of a lot of extra Bobby Heenan. I also think we got robbed by him going to WCW and not returning sooner than he did. I always wish he left WCW like in 98 and came back for, you know, a stretch. Because he was fine those first couple of years. By 98, 99, he's just completely mailing it in. So I do wish he had found his way back up north during that time to be part of the WWF during their biggest period. I mean, obviously, one of the all-time greats. We don't need to go too in-depth on his career. We, like you said, Scott, we chronicle it here on the podcast every week. But he's synonymous wrestling. It's someone that was universally loved by everyone. If you could find a bad Bobby Heenan performance before, like, 1996, I dare you to try and find one, because I don't know if it exists, whether it was in the ring, whether it was commentary, whether it was, you know, prime time, whatever it was. He was great, and I was glad that they re-aired it, because they actually had put this up on the old on-demand service, that Bobby Heenan and Lord Alfred Hayes match. They put that in the Bobby Heenan collection on the network. If you've never seen it, it's really fun. Do you know where that's from, Cal? Was it? And it was from like the 70s, but what promotion was it? You know, it was like Australia or something. Wasn't it something random?
Was it? I know of the one from the AWA in 1980.
Is that the one where, I mean, obviously Al's the face, and they kind of, it's like a lot of theatrics. Is that, maybe it's the same one.
Well, the one in the AWA, they were both heels. It was like a rare, weird heel versus heel.
No, I was trying to figure that out myself, that it seemed weird, that, because I don't remember Alfred being a face much. So no, I thought that was...
I feel like the one on the network, though, he's a face.
Yeah. Okay. See, I haven't watched the one on the network. I'm just the one that I've seen from the AWA.
What was Alfred wearing in the one you've seen?
Considered, like a really... she's red, I think.
All right, see, in this one he's wearing like a blue singlet, like Andre the Giant.
It's been a long time since I've seen it, but anyway, I mean, they had some great moments in the AWA. Bobby had a whole career in the AWA before he came to the WWF that was longer than his WWF run. You know, unfortunately, there's not a lot of video of it, but you know, by all accounts, he was legendary. I mean, he was on the cover of so many wrestling mags in the 70s with, you know, the Crimson Mask. He was involved in so many matches. Like, he was a great wrestler, really. He could bump so well. He could get great heat, obviously. He was small he was limited. He was never going to go beyond that, manager role, manager who wrestled. But he was part of so many big matches in the AWA where the blow off to the feud would be him getting in the ring, and then the faces finally getting vengeance on Heenan, who had caused them so much misery over the months. You know, he managed the Blackjacks. Blackjack Lonzo was his first big protege. He was big in St. Louis. He was basically the only manager allowed in St. Louis. Like, Sam Muchnick, the promoter in St. Louis, didn't like the character of the heel manager, and he didn't employ them, but Heenan was so good, he made an exception. And I think Dick the Bruiser probably helped him get in, because that's where Heenan started, in Indianapolis. He was an Indiana guy. He got in with Dick the Bruiser's promotion there in the mid-60s, and Bruiser opened some doors with him, because Bruiser was big in the AWA as well. And throughout the 70s, just huge in the AWA, his run with Bockwinkle. I mean, Bockwinkle, he started managing Bockwinkle before he became world champion in 1975, and they were still doing Bockwinkle and Stevens as a tag team. And then he would manage Bockwinkle through the entire run that Bockwinkle had as a heel champion in the AWA that lasted into 1984, so almost a decade. He went away briefly to Georgia in 79. Apparently he hated it there, hated Ole Anderson. But that was where the first Heenan family actually happened, apparently, was in Georgia with like Mass Superstar and I think some of I can't think of the names right now. And then he came back to the AWA and resumed his run and had a, you know, in the early 80s, the territory was really hot. Actually, the AWA was really successful, you know, for most of the time that he was there. And he was a big part of it. And, yeah, came to the WWF at a perfect time where Wizard had passed away. So there was an opening for a manager. Albano had turned babyface, so there was one less heel manager, and he fit in, you know, perfectly. A lot of the AWA guys had come over, though, of course, at the same time or just before, and then had a complete second awesome run. He had already had a Hall of Fame career before coming to the WWF. Like, if he never did anything after that, if he never went to the WWF, he would still, I'm sure, have been voted into like all the major Hall of Fames, like the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame, just for his pre-WWF run, because it was so strong. And then on top of that, he has the big run as a manager in the WWF, and then adds the commentary side of things to it, which, you know, he was one of the best color commentary guys in wrestling. And of course, his masterpiece being the Royal Rumble in 1992, one of the great shows of all time.
And WrestleMania 8. I feel like it's a two. Yeah. You need like both. You know what I mean? Like, I feel like they go so well together. Right? And those two are like the peak of Gorilla and Bobby in general. So, yeah, I would say, I mean, 92 is the peak, but I think that's like a two-part story to me, those two pay-per-views.
Yeah, and there was also the barbershop incident with the Rockers that he commentated, and he put over that whole, the Shawn Michaels heel turn so well, and was hilarious in that too. Like, just, he was on fire at that time, totally on fire. And yeah, I mean, what a career. I mean, he was great in so many different areas. One of the best all around performers in wrestling history. And it's you know, there'll never be another like him.
No. One of a kind. I mean, you saw so many people too say how he could have been a you know, sitcom star or a comedian. Like, he could have been beyond wrestling. He had that much, that great a quick wit and timing. And no, I mean, yeah, absolutely one of a kind. One of the greats of all time. It'll be interesting on the Greatest Duty Wrestler Ever project here at PlaceManation.com. We can talk about more of that later, where he'll finish. I know he was kind of a bit of a point of contention through some people debating whether, you know, did he wrestle enough to really rank high? Where would you put him? Because if you're going to rank him, he probably has to be pretty high, even though I guess there's that gray area of like how much of his managerial stuff should really count. I mean, his commentary doesn't really count because we're not factoring that in. So it's kind of a slippery slope. Like, he was active through a lot of the time he was managing, but can you just count, you know, his heel work from the time circling around matches? So it's kind of a tricky one.
Yeah, I'm going to rank him probably in the top 70. Mm. I mean, I'll probably be the high guy.
No, I think Will might have him like top 10.
Maybe not top 10, but yeah, pretty high. Because his peaks as a wrestler, strictly as a wrestler in the WWF, were pretty high. A lot of people point to the Survivor Series match in 1989, where he was like a last-second substitution and then stole the show, stole the match. And then we've seen him in tags and all that.
Yeah, WrestleMania 5, he gets squashed, but it's super memorable.
You know, kicking
the shit out of him. Yeah, Terry Taylor's highlight.
Totally. Yeah, so that's a feather, another feather in Bobby's cap.
No pun intended.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, I think his people are starting to appreciate him as a wrestler more and more over the years. If when they start looking at the footage, and there is footage of his pre-WWF run out there when he's in matches, and it's really good. There's a lot of good stuff that people should check out from the AWA, but also from Indianapolis in the 70s. Or at least it was at one time available on YouTube. I'm not sure if it still is, but
and it looks like that Hayes match is the 81 from AWA. So I don't know why I thought I remembered Hayes being a face. I must have just misremembered it. But yeah, so that's on the collection. It's worth watching to see an anomaly.
Oh yeah,
it is. Yeah, it is.
It's a lot of
really
fun.
Good match. Great match. Yeah.
All right, so that is Bobby Heenan. Our buddy Peter over at Greetings from Allentown did a full episode talking about Bobby Heenan's legacy, so I recommend checking that out for sure. It's over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed on iTunes, so subscribe and download that if you don't already. It's a great show anyway. You should be listening to it, but that particular episode, if you want to hear more about Bobby Heenan, because why not? He's so good. And we are going to talk more about Bobby Heenan tonight many, many times. And what we're going to do first is, since we are starting a new year tonight, 1987, here in our Vintage Vaults, we wanted to head back very briefly and just talk about 1986. We didn't really do this for 85, Scott. I don't feel like we're like fully in the groove now. That Kelly's pretty much been with us for all these shows, and you know, D'Amato's been with us for the paper. So I feel like we're more in a, you know, there's more to break down and look at now that we're doing
symmetrical.
This. Yeah, and this will be more of a yearly thing for us now. So, you know, we can talk about the year as a whole, and then we can kind of give out some awards. But, you know, for me, it was an interesting year. I learned a lot of stuff that I never really knew. For many years, to me, it was just the pay-per-views and eventually the Saturday Night's Main Events once I got to really see them. Not having the house shows to really fill the gaps on what else happened in that year. And, you know, one show that's grown greatly in my mind is WrestleMania 2. Like, I had never really had much respect for that show. Now, having watched it a couple times recently and having watched it after all the build-up, I can definitely say I've kind of garnered more enjoyment and respect. I'm still putting it toward the bottom of the WrestleManias for sure, but I get it a little bit more. I do think they probably went, you know, a little bit bigger than they should have in many regard, but we covered that in great detail at the time. You know, the Hogan Savage feud, even though it started in late 85, like I never really knew that they had that big of a feud. And at this point, I thought they just had like a match here or there. I didn't realize how intense it was. Seeing a lot of the Steamboat and Jake stuff beyond just the two big matches, that was cool. You know, a guy that has really, not that he had far to climb on my list for greatest WWE wrestler ever. He was already probably top two, Hulk Hogan. But he's really solidified his position by watching a lot of these early Hogan years matches. You always heard about how he was very different pre, like, 87-ish, and he really was. I mean, his matches, he's a force of nature in a lot of these matches. It was really cool seeing him mix it up with different guys and really seeing him work at such a different pacing and different style. He's a guy to me that has gained in my eyes watching him in 86. So those are kind of few things that jumped out at me, Scott. What, I mean, you obviously, and it really isn't an old joke, but you obviously lived this era. I didn't, I'm you know, reliving it. Did anything change for you versus like your memories or as a fan at the time versus what you've seen over the last, you know, few months that we've been doing 86?
I definitely, I mean, I knew it at the time, but I also, it was strengthened for me this, when we did these shows, how important, Hogan was as not just the world champion, but as a character and as a personality, because we've had some shows without him that have been utter stinkers, and he's just such an anchor to this company now. Like 84, obviously he's just, you know, just won the title and that's nice. 85, you know, he didn't have to do, you know, WrestleMania 1. Yeah, it was him and Piper, but T was really the big guy that helped him and help him get like some major cred on that show. And he had some decent feuds in 85. He had the good matches with Morocco. And but I feel like 86, he really established himself as the man. True, he's not the work rate guy that that Ric Flair was at the time in 1986 as NWA champion, but Hogan was making money hand over fist, filling arenas, and he just established himself as the stud guy in this company. And I it's fortified for me now that we're watching these shows. I didn't realize how much dead weight there still was in this company. I didn't notice it as much when I was a fan at the time.
We see it starting to seep in now in early 87. Like this show and the one we're going to talk about next week, you're starting to see a lot of new blood cycled in. So I think they probably realized it too by the end of 86, how much they had to kind of recycle out of there.
Right. No, they definitely did. I mean, we had some, I mean, you know, Jose Luis Rivera and Lombardi. And I mean, those guys belong on syndicated shows. They should not be on MSG house shows. Not at all. And I mean, by the end of 86, it was evident. We're going to talk about him tonight. He's on our show tonight. Junkyard Dog is just getting lapped now as a babyface character. Guys are passing him left and right. And the evolution of Savage. You know, he was a great worker, but relied on a lot of tricks and that kind of thing. And his promos are really good. But I feel like by the end of this calendar year, he's been established as like the heel alpha dog, maybe even more than Orndorff or, you know, or Bundy or any of those guys. I think Savage has proven throughout 1986 that he's a keeper, and probably could be a great babyface. But right now, he's just one of the most awesome heels in the company. And another guy that we didn't see at the Garden as much as I thought. So that's two. And three,
and just while you're on Savage real quick, one thing I did forget too, I didn't realize how in-depth and long the Tito Savage feud was.
I didn't realize
all the matches they had, the Bruno stuff. Like, that was really cool to check out and relive. So that's another thing that really stood out to me. I also learned about Adrian Adonis getting fired. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either. But the other thing is how those matches just got better and better and better. Yeah. And it shows how great a worker Tito is. And thirdly, you know, we talk about the Garden, and we talk about, you know, it's MSG, it's the crown jewel, the palace. But we had some stinkers, and I didn't realize that. Wow, there were some really bad MSG shows. It felt like every MSG show was great, but as we've noticed, there have been some real dogs, and I was surprised, we're going to have another year, 1987, where we're going to have a long, I think, five-month stretch of five straight house shows. And as much as we sit here and go, man, I love all these house shows, five in a row might be a bit much if they can't fill the show with solid talent. So those are my 3 points. The evolution of Hogan as the top guy in the company, the growth of Savage and the heels kind of lining up, and then the fact that MSG, as great as MSG is as a building and some of the legendary moments, 1986 had a couple of real stinkers. And I'm looking forward, hoping to the 1987 shows not having as much top early, like mid, like curtain jerking, early mid card junk that a lot of these MSG shows did. So that's what I got just overall out of 86 in terms of characters and work, you know, and matches and things like that. Kel? What do you gather from this year?
Well, you know, 1986 was the year I became a wrestling fan, so it's always going to have like a big emotional thing for me. But yeah, it's far from like the best year in company history. Although it's tough, like judging it by the MSG shows alone, and I was watching a lot of the Saturday Night's main events too, and of course I've seen WrestleMania 2 a million times. But judging it just by the MSG shows, it's wow. There was some, like you said, Scott, some real stinkers, just dud after dud after dud. Ted Arcidi, Siviafi, Pedro Morales washed up way past his prime, wrestling every goddamn month.
And winning. Fucking winning.
And winning most matches.
Not jobbing. I mean,
if not all.
Not just winning. Not even getting pinned.
Exactly. So yeah, judging it by the MSG shows, it was a really down year. I mean, there was actually, there was a lot of really good matches on the MSG shows, especially like earlier in 1986. And then in the second half, the quality started to slip a bit, and we didn't have the four-star matches anymore. But overall, I mean, I've said this before, like from the summer of 86 up to WrestleMania 3 is one of the best periods, though, actually, for WWF, because they had so many great characters, so many great wrestlers, so many great feuds, angles, a lot of very memorable matches, great matches. So I can't you know, totally destroy 1986, because, you know, like the Hogan-Orndorff feud is one of the most memorable of Hogan's run as champ. Hogan and Kamala, great stuff there. Piper turning babyface, great stuff there. Randy Savage, like you said, Scott, I mean, he had a great year, was the heel anchor, like you said, that's totally true. You know, gets into the feud with Steamboat, that's legendary. And Greg Valentine had a great year too, in the ring. He was, you know, often the lone highlight of a lot of those MSG shows. Hogan, of course, was great. You know, I didn't get to see him quite often in MSG, but when he was there, he was awesome. Bret Hart was another guy I constantly mentioned as someone that really stood out, you know, amongst a sea of mediocrity, a lot of real poor workers. That Bret, you know, he was definitely, you know, night in, night out, one of the best workers, great timing, great healing. Just he was, even in 1986, he was awesome. And then we got Jake Roberts coming in. Immediately shot up to be one of the top heels, and by the end of the year was ready to become one of the top baby faces. Like, what a year he had in 1986. Like, in less than a year, he went from, yeah, one of the top heels to, by the end of the 86, he was ready to turn babyface and have a huge run there. So, you know, and he, you know, was great in the Steamboat feud. And great in other matches, like random MSG matches, where he was just, you know, great with his psychology, great at being a heel. So yeah, there was a ton of talent, there was a ton of scrubs and duds. It's a mixed bag year, but they really, you know, it's funny, like the MSG shows were stronger at the beginning of 86 than in at the tail end of 86, but I think the company as a whole got stronger. Angle wise, storyline wise. Then of course Superstars started, and the look changed and became really, you know, flashy and looked super professional and really stood out. And that was another thing that hooked me, I think, because I missed that, the whole, you know, dirty, dungy or grungy arena era of wrestling. Like I got in just as the changeover to Superstars and improved production quality started. So, you know, that was part of it. This Saturday night's main event we're about to talk about, man, you know, that's another reason I fell in love with wrestling. Like that run of Saturday night's main events from October, the November one, and then to January one, and then the lead up to WrestleMania 3 is just an unbelievable run of entertainment, great pro wrestling. So yeah, it was a crazy year. I mean, it had it all. It had great wrestling. It had some of the worst wrestling you'll ever see anywhere. but it had some of the greatest professional wrestlers of all time, Hall of Famers, all side by side. And then Vince and Jesse on commentary and Gorilla Monsoon on commentary, you know, like great commentators. It was a cool year, with some duds in there, but I think I'll choose to remember the best of it instead of the worst of it.
Harley Race is another guy too. I've gained some more appreciation for watching some of these early matches here. What a workhorse he was in these early months in the promotion. All right, so let's touch on a few different awards here. So match of the year for us. So, you know, big event, WrestleMania 2, Science Main Event, and all the MSGs. You know, I think Hogan Savage from January looks to maybe clock in as our highest. Scott had a 4.5. Kelly, you and me had it at fours. We had Santana Savage in March. You weren't on that show. Scott and I had it at fours. Let's see what else here. I know WrestleMania 2, what do we have? Bulldogs, Dream Team. We both had that 3.5, and that's the best match on that show. Santana Savage in April, not as high across the board. Kelly, you had it at 4, but we were a tick lower. May, I had it at 4. You guys had it at 3.5. I think that Hogan Savage may be... the tag with Bruno, we all had it 4 stars. So that might,
yeah.
It looks to be maybe the second right now.
Yeah.
I think I put Hogan and Savage ahead of that.
Yeah.
Not by much, but I put it.
Well, it's technically ahead of it based on your vote, based on your
right.
grade.
Well, that's true. Yeah, that's true.
Because you had it at 4.5. So those are our top two matches of the year.
Yeah.
Those are our top two matches of the year. You'd say Hogan Savage in January, and then Bruno and Tito against Savage and Adonis in June.
Adonis.
No, I'm sorry. Yeah, in July, the Cage.
Yeah. The Cage, yeah.
Yeah. And then
that's
looks
my
like,
favorite match of the year.
The tag?
The tag Cage, yeah.
And then looks like maybe Santana, Tito. I don't know if you had watched it recently, Kelly, the one from March. You weren't on that one. We had it at 4. Scott and I.
Yeah, I did watch it around that time. I don't know, maybe 3.5. I don't think I would go 4 on it, but well, maybe. It was really good, though. I mean, that, like you've already said, like that feud was awesome. Even the worst match of it was the first tag between Bruno, Tito, and Adonis and Savage, and that was still a really good match too.
Right.
It was just one great match after the next in that feud.
It was a great feud. I mean, worst match of the year. There's so many that we. I mean, like all the Ted Arcidi stuff. You know, we gave duds across the board. You know, some of the ones are 2, like Moolah, McIntyre, whatever is a waste. One Tonga, King Tonga versus Paul Christie, we gave duds. I'm trying to look at ones that we gave duds across the board to. Spivey and Christie.
What's that one? There's a one Pedro match that we all fucking just torched. I can't remember.
Well, this one's bad too. George Steele and Volkov from June, we gave duds.
Oh, God, that is awful. Yes.
Adonis and Tony Atlas. I remember being really sad having to give Adonis a dud. Yeah. That was brutal. Gurria, Arcidi, terrible. That's it. So
my
far.
Worst. My worst match of the year was the Brunzel, Jim Brunzel versus Jim Neidhart.
Oh, right.
20-minute snooze fest. I think it was from the May 86 show. I know you guys actually gave it, a star and a half. But for me, that was torture. That was like I'd be strapped down in a chair with my eyes forced open watching that garbage. That was.
I have to say, JR, that Gurria Arcidi match in September might be the most unwatchable piece of shit I think we've ever watched in the history of this podcast.
Well, and even
it's pretty close.
Hillbilly and Fuji from December, that was pretty shit too. Yeah, there's a lot of duds across the board. That Atlas Adonis could be it too, because for us to give Adonis a dud, you know it's going to be really fucking terrible. But Steel Volkov is brutal. So a tough year. MVP, I mean, it's Hogan, right? I mean, he pretty much won it every time he was on. So I think he won 8 total. He's one of those being a couple of those being a split. But pretty much, I mean, just about every time he was on, he won. You know, Piper won a couple, Savage won a couple. But Hogan's really the most consistent here, where every time he's on, he's winning MVP.
Yep.
Yeah, I agree.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt. Savage gets a lot of votes. But I feel like we didn't see Savage as much as, I mean, because we need to vote on what we watch. And I feel like Savage wasn't on enough, which is unfortunate. I think he gets handicapped in that aspect. But, I mean, every time Hogan was on, the crowd was hot and everything he was doing was great. So I don't think there's any question.
Savage
there.
Is in the discussion with the Tito series, with the Hogan matches, with the Bruno stuff, and then with the Jake match. You know, that kind of came in late. He got weighed down a bit by Steel. You know, he was in those things. but, I mean, other than that, yeah, he'd probably be my number 2 for the year.
Mm. Yeah, me too. I'd say Savage would be number 2. Hogan also had the huge angle with Bundy, the huge angle with Orndorff to add to it all. Yeah, you just can't really touch him because he had so much high-end
stuff. Plus the match with Kamala to close the year, which was really good.
Kamala, great.
And then maybe Piper and Bobby maybe my tie for third. Jake, you know, he's in the conversation
Jake's
too.
Jake's in there. Yeah.
Tito.
Valentine was a workhorse in the ring, but didn't have much else to add to his MVP candidacy, but he was always great in the ring. That sounds about right.
Mm. I roll with that.
Yeah. Worst worker of the year. I mean, Arcidi had a stranglehold on it for a while, but we didn't see a ton of him. Elmer was in there. Siviafi, of course, a whipping boy. But he got better. He got better as it went on.
He did. Yeah, he did.
Kirchner.
I think it's got to be Arcidi.
Yeah, he's the worst.
Not one single positive thing about him.
Kirchner was pretty bad, too. I mean, if you want to go by, like, presentation versus output, I think you then get into like a Steel, a Morales, like guys that were actually winning matches and kind of slightly getting pushes that were fucking terrible. At least a guy like I mean, I guess RCD was getting pushed too, but it was really low level push. Some of these other guys were, you know, some of these other guys were getting actual pushes, or like a guy like Pedro who's winning match after match and is just awful. So I think they're in the conversation too.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure.
What do you think, Scott? Anything in there?
I mean, it's got to be RCD. I mean, he was there was really no one redeeming quality. Yeah, he was a, you know, gigantic dude, but I mean, he brought not one match did he bring anything to the table of any kind of quality. I mean, literally every match he was in, he literally looked like he had no idea why he was even in the ring. It was dreadful.
Yeah.
It was dreadful. It was good that they finally just cut bait on that and that it was just a failed experiment.
Do we have a favorite moment from the whole year? You know, Bundy attacking Hogan at that Science Man event. I think that, you know, I remember talking very highly of that one. Bruno winning the cage match. That's one we really spoke highly of that we liked a lot. The Pit. Was that with...
Yes. Yeah.
What was the October Orndorff with?
Yeah. Orndorff and Heenan.
Yeah, that was a really good one.
Yeah, that was a big highlight.
Yeah. Anything else we're missing off the top here?
I don't think so. I think we're good otherwise.
The RCD Award. So it was, I mean, RCD clearly was the most juice for the year. He won it 4 times. The Bulldogs won a lot too. I mean, you could really call this the Bulldogs Award. They won at least 1, 2, 4 plus 2 other splits, 3 other splits. So they're up there. Hogan obviously always up there too. In Morocco, there's some real juice heads here in '86.
Yeah, it was definitely. Yeah. Dr. Zahorian was a busy man in '86.
Yes,
I don't think there's any doubt about that.
Probably could retire after this year.
All right. So overall, Kelly, if you had to give a grade to the year of 1986 out of 10. Just from what we've watched. So factor in the Science Man events, the pay-per-views, the MSG storylines, kind of booking, just overall, like what's your grade for the year?
So yeah, including everything for 1986.
Everything we've watched.
Everything we've watched.
So you can't, don't factor in like shit you've seen from like Boston or other, you know what I'm saying? Like,
right. Okay.
The stuff we've watched, what would you grade it? But you can factor in the overarching stories, like Hogan versus Orndorff was a feud, but you know,
yeah,
we saw it. So I'm just saying, like, don't count great matches that you saw in '86 that we had, you know, weren't on our radar at all.
Right. Right. That's fair. Well, like I said, the MSG stuff, if you did a total grade for all those shows, it'd be around a 5 out of 10 for the whole year, probably. I know I rated a lot of shows 5 out of 10, and I dipped below a few times, and I think I went as high as 7 on a MSG show. But then you factor in the Saturday Night's main event stuff, which almost every episode was really good, good or great. Just a really, really good year for that show. WrestleMania 2 is, yeah, not a great show. It's bloated. It's almost like they've come back to this now with their Manias and SummerSlams. You know, too many celebrities, too many matches, 3 locations, a lot of duds. I mean, it rallied in Los Angeles at the end and finished on a high note, but I'll give the year a 6.5 out of 10. How does that sound?
Jeez, that's a little strong.
Is that too high? Okay. I don't know.
I mean, because I think of some of the greatest years in wrestling in DOTF and where those would rank, and at a 6.5 seems too close to those, you know what I mean? But, I mean, that's me, you know. I would maybe... We just saw so much crappy stuff. And, I mean, there are really great angles. We saw really great matches. And it's a year – if you would have asked me, like, 4 years ago, what do you think of 86? I probably would have said trash bag year, right? I'm thinking big event, WrestleMania 2, a couple of high spots here, but dead until WrestleMania 3. Like, the promotion didn't go anywhere until WrestleMania 3. Like, the way Vince talks about the smoky bingo halls is what I always thought of pre-WrestleMania 3. Like, that, you know, that's just, like, 3 is right when the lights came on. But watching it has definitely raised my respect of 86 as a whole, for sure. So I'd go higher than I would have in the past. I mean, I'm probably not far off from you, Kelly. I'm probably like a 5.5-ish, 5, 5.5, somewhere in there, knowing that there are years that I just like better coming up that I would rate higher. And I mean, no year to me, there's maybe one year that'll be like a 10 in the next decade or so. And that's, you know, maybe like 97 to me. And even that's got a lot of junk in it. So, you know, there's probably not too many years that are going to come close to a 10. So 6.5 is like perilously high to my best years. So I'll go 5.5 just to be nice, but maybe 5.25. What do you think, Scott?
Well, it's funny because I gave, as I'm looking at the show grades, I gave a couple shows as low as a 2, and I gave one as high as an 8. So, I'll give it a 5.5. We had some good moments. Hogan was awesome, but I mean, there were some, it sucks. There were some MSG house shows that just were just sludge. And that sucks because, you know, it's the Garden, man. You're not allowed to have sludge, but we sure did. And I knew anyway, and I'm sure, and I know you guys did too, that going into this year, we knew we were going to have some sludge moments. But I really do feel that the roster will work itself out, and it was going to work itself out. So I feel very confident heading into 1987 that we're going to have – things are going to be better, and there's still more cherry-picking of other territories. And we've kind of tossed names about casually that we're going to see more extensively in 87. But 86 was a year that was still in transition for me, in my opinion, as a fan, about the roster. But I think the things that were established, we had 4 or 5 guys that were firmly established as stars. Hogan, Savage, Piper, Bulldogs, Hart Foundation. Although it didn't seem like it at the time, JR, and we talk about that a lot, about how it seemed like most of 86 they were kind of, you know, floating around aimlessly until we got to the end of the year. Otherwise, I mean, there was a lot of dreck. So it's hard to ignore that, even with the great moments that Hogan and Savage and Piper and those guys gave us. So I'll give it a 5.5. Now, the highest, just quickly going over this, the highest grade I gave for a show was 8. That was the January 27th MSG show that had that Hogan-Savage match. Let's see. You gave, JR, let me think. You gave a couple of 7s. The October 4th Science Main Event and the November 29th Science Main Event, you gave 7s. Kelly, which is funny because Kelly gave a lot of trash grades, so I'm really surprised he said 6.5 at all.
Well, I'm including the Saturday night's main event.
So yeah, that's true. Well, 6.5 you gave of the shows you did. Let's see. Oh, you did give the February 17th house show a 7.
Yeah. That was my favorite.
And your lowest was a 3.5, and that was for that. Oh, no, I'm sorry, a 2, and that was for that last. Oh, Pete was on. Pete gave that show a 2. Your lowest was a 3.5, which was the that June house show that's just fucking garbage. So we were all over the map with show grades anyway.
So. All right. Any other final thoughts? Anyone? Last call.
Looking forward to 87.
Yeah.
All right.
Seeing the roster changes. Big roster changes.
For sure.
Yep.
All right, well, why don't we start diving into 1987 in a moment. So let's take a minute. We'll listen to this break. We'll come back, and we will open up a brand new year. Underneath the stars, I was making some noise. I was a working boy. Up at the top of a voice saying, look at me, mama, I'm making some noise. Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Hey, pro wrestling announcer Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you are all subscribed to all the great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. It's really easy to do. Just head to iTunes or your preferred podcatcher app today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, which, of course, includes the full archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, the Place to Be Nation pod feed, and the pro wrestling only feed. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. And be sure to give Justin your true thoughts. I mean, don't hold back. After all, he is kind of a jerk. Just listen to Scott.
Place to Be Nation's JT Rizzero and Chad Campbell here. We want to let you know that we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlayStation.com. And we offer those to you on 3 great feeds. On the Place to Be Nation wrestling feed, we bring you the Mothership, the original Place to Be podcast, as well as Main Event, Lucha Afterground, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows, as well as the Our Vantage Point podcast and Jeff Learns Wrestling. In addition to these full-length shows, we also deliver quick-hit pod blasts on topics old and new.
Over on the Pro Wrestling Only feed, we dive deep inside the wrestling business with a stacked army of experts leading the way. The feed features potpourri shows such as This Week in Wrestling, Greetings from Allentown, Psychology is Dead, Puro Potpourri, Stacy and Elliot's Bogus Journey, and the Military Industrial Suplex. We also have shows that focus intently on certain topics like Letters from Center Stage, Space City, an NWA Classics On Demand adventure, Through the Years, Strong Style History, Strong Style Story, and Mount Olympus. Plus, the feed has the full archives of legendary shows like Titans of Wrestling, Where the Big Boys Play, Letters from Kayfabe, and much more. And on our popular Place to Be Nation Pop podcast feed, we offer such great shows as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, PTBN Dadcast, Go Home in a Box, NBA Team, and Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, Geek and Sassy, and Imaginary Stories podcasts.
You can find all of these current shows plus archives of our past podcasts, including The Kevin Kelly Show, as well by subscribing to all of our feeds on iTunes, and while there, be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows, plus others, available on PlacementNation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus in-depth stretch projects and more. Be sure to support our site by using PlacementNation.com/Amazon when shopping online, and download our free PTB Vintage Vault Refresh ebooks via the links on our site. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, in Fall River, Massachusetts, TheHistoryOfWrestling.com, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlacementNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
What's up, everybody? This is Kevin Kelly, longtime announcer with the WWE, now the voice of Ring of Honor Wrestling. No better place to be than right here on the Place to Be podcast. Make sure you tune in every week.
All right, Nation, we are back here about to delve into the January 3rd, 1987 Science event. We're going to have a little fun tonight, as Wang Chung once sung. And, of course, you can hear that. You can hang Wang Chung underneath what we're saying right now, because they were the number two song in the nation. Of course, we are pretty hot off the heels of our last show, the December 86, and the Bangles, Walk Like an Egyptian, was number one still at this point. So, Wang Chung takes us into the Pop Culture Corner with Scott Criscolo.
Thank you, JR. And as I mentioned, as JR said, different song we'll play tonight because we didn't want to play the Bangles two shows in a row. The Bangles, Walk Like an Egyptian, still number one. This is a Saturday, so the first official Billboard Top 100 poll of 1987 came out today, January 3rd. So Walk Like an Egyptian, as I said, number one again. As you hear, we're hanging our Wang Chung pretty low because everybody's having fun tonight. That was number two. Number three, Notorious by Duran Duran. Great song.
And Puff Daddy.
Number four, Shake You Down by Gregory Abbott. Now, when you hear the guy's name, you're like, who the fuck is he? But when you hear the song, you absolutely know what song this is. And I think I mentioned it on the last show as well. Number five, The Way It Is by Bruce Hornsby and The Range. Number six, C'est La Vie, Little Robbie Neville.
C'est la vie, c'est la vie.
Number seven, Control by our girl Janet Jackson. Number eight, War by Bruce Springsteen. I believe that was the remake of the Edwin Starr song, you know, whoa, good God, y'all. Number nine, Stand By Me by Benny King, because that movie came out at some point in 1987. We may talk about that movie at some point, JR. You're going to be talking about a lot of movies tonight, by the way. And at number 10, Don't Get Me Wrong by The Pretenders, Chrissy Hynde action. So there's your top 10 for this week, came out on this day, January 3rd, 1987.
Do you know War and Peace was originally titled War, What Is It Good For? But Tolstoy changed it.
Really? Very interesting. Revolutionary, that Tolstoy guy was. And then Edwin Starr stole. Probably should have got sued anyway. Anyway, all right. Now, JR, I spared you big time. Because on New Year's Day, I counted. I have the whole list right here. Let me see. This is how many movies came out on New Year's Day that Thursday. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, 16, 17, 18, 19, 20, 21, 22, 23, 24, 25, 26, 27, 28, 29, 30, 31, 32, 33, 34, 37, 38, 39, 40, 40 movies came out on New Year's Day.
This is a fucking porn company putting those out? It's 40 movies in a day?
Caballero Films presents.
Jesus.
But I am not going to – we're not doing all 40 of them. We are going to do a decent amount, though, because there were a lot of movies that day that did make over $1 million. So we'll at least do that. So here we go. And a few of them, JR, you definitely do remember because you were a spry 6-year-old in January of 87. Young buck. This one made $4 million. Very well known because it involved one of the greatest NBA players of the 1980s. Kelly might remember this one. It is called?
Kelly Tripica.
No. Amazing Grace and Chuck.
Nope. Don't remember.
Is
that
Charles Barkley?
No, it's not Charles Barkley. Another great.
Chuck Person?
Not Chuck Person. No, not Chuck Person.
Chuck Murdoch, a 12-year-old boy from Montana and the son of a military jet pilot, becomes anxious after seeing a Minuteman missile on a school field trip, which intensified by a nightmare of a fork dropping after being told that the speed and effectiveness would be done before the dropped fork hits the floor. Whatever that all means. Starring Jamie Lee Curtis, Gregory Peck, William Peterson, and fictional Boston Celtics player Amazing Grace Smith, played by Alex English.
Alex English with the Denver Nuggets. Yep. All right, next. This made $2 million. Oh, no, I'm sorry. That's coming up after this one. This one made $4 million, a sequel, American Ninja 2, The Confrontation. Yeah. There we go.
Now promoted to Army Rangers, Joe Armstrong and Curtis Jackson are sent to a remote Caribbean island to aid the Marine Corps in investigating the disappearance of many of its soldiers. Starring Michael Dudikoff, Steve James, Jeff Weston, Gary Conway, Larry Poindexter, and Mike Stone.
Okay. This I know you saw. You definitely saw this during the first week of January.
Was it American Tale featuring Under the Sea?
Under the Sea, yep. And his girlfriend Mulan. It made $2 million. It is close, though. The Care Bears Adventure in Wonderland.
I did not see that. I wish I did. In Care-a-Lot, the Care Bears are visited by White Rabbit, the uncle of Swift Heart Rabbit. The White Rabbit gives the Care Bears the task of finding the missing Princess of Heart, who is to be crowned Queen of Wonderland. Otherwise, the villainous Wizard of Wonderland will gain the throne. Starring Matt Rotella, Bob Dermer, Eva Elmos, Dan Hennessy, Jim, of course, these are all the voices, Luba Goy. That's about it. No one else. Not that any of those were known either, but...
Okay.
Keith Hampshire was the Mad Hatter and the Jabberwocky. So,
big time
crossover here. Adventures of Wonderland and the Care Bears.
That's right. Jabberwocky. Ugh, okay. This movie made $2 million. It is called Date with an Angel. That's definitely starring Matt Rotella.
How do you date with an angel? Date with an Angel tells the story of Jim Sanders, an executive at a cosmetics company, about to marry Patty Winston, the spoiled daughter of Jim's boss. Unknowingly, Jim suffers from a brain tumor. His headaches have gotten worse. It is suggested that he will die until an angel arrives on the scene, given the task of bringing Jim's soul back to heaven on the night of his engagement party. Starring Michael Knight, Phoebe Cates, Emmanuel Biot, David Dukes, Phil Brock, Albert Macklin, B.B. Besh. Is that not a lot of big names?
David Duke? The KKK guy?
David Dukes.
David Duke?
Dukes.
Oh, thank God. All right. Oh, Christ. Speaking of Rotella, oh, my God. I had to sit through this movie with him. This movie made $4 million. Ugh, this movie's awful. Leonard Part 6, which is easily one of the worst pieces of shit in the history of cinema. I don't know how the hell it made $4 million.
Leonard Parker, a CIA spy-turned-restaurateur. According to the opening sequence of the movie, the title refers to the idea that the film is actually the sixth installment of a series featuring the adventures of Leonard. 1 through 5 were locked up in interest of world security. Of course, there are actually no films preceding this one. Starring Bill Cosby, Joe Don Baker, Moses Gunn, John Hostetler, and not much else.
Nope. One of the worst pieces of crap.
Notorious bomb.
Earned several golden raspberries. One of the worst films ever made.
Yes, utterly dreadful. All right, this one made $1.59 million, Making Mr. Right.
Let's see. Is it Mr. M-I-S-T-E-R or Mr. M-R?
M-R, period. Yep. The abbreviation, yes.
Jeff Peters, an emotionally repressed scientist, sounds like most wrestling fans, just replace scientist, who cannot stand others because of their intellectual inferiority, dreams of a deep space exploration, which would be difficult because of lack of human contact for long periods of time. He develops a Ulysses android for the purpose of space exploration, since an android would not be affected by the isolation. Starring John Malkovich and Magnuson. Ooh. And music was by Chaz Jankel. Polly okay. Bergen, Laurie Metcalf before Roseanne.
Yep. All right. This one made $3.14 million. It is called Maurice. Not Maurice. Maurice.
All right. Maurice the film. Let's see. During a trip to a windswept beach, Maurice Hall, an 11-year-old schoolboy, receives instructions about the sacred mysteries of sex from his teacher, who wants to, it's took a weird turn, who wants to explain to the follower's boy the changes he would experience in puberty. Starring James Willoughby, Hugh Grant, Rupert Graves, Simon Callow, Billy Whitelaw, if you haven't picked up yet, this is a British movie, Patrick Godfrey, Ben Kingsley, Peter Aya, and Helena Bonham Carter, uncredited. Maurice, learning about sex.
Maurice. All right, this one made $2.14 million, and it was the third of a movie series, not nearly as good as the first. Well, the first one is awesome. The second one is, and this one was pretty bad. Meatballs 3.
Summer Job.
The first Meatballs had Bill Murray in it. So, yeah.
When porn star Roxy DuJour is denied entrance into the afterlife, she was given one last chance to help some poor soul on Earth, and she finds Rudy Gerner working at a Summer River resort. Roxy's given the task of helping Rudy lose his virginity and allowed to be allowed into the afterlife, starring Patrick Dempsey, Sally Kellerman, Shannon Tweed, Carolyn Ray.
Shannon Tweed's in it, so that pretty much says that.
By the way, do you know who Patrick Dempsey's boss's name in the movie is?
No, I haven't seen this movie in ages.
Mean Gene.
Scheme Gene. What a shock. Porn star with Mean Gene in it. What a shock. Next, this made $3.2 million. Pinocchio and the Emperor of the Night. I didn't realize it was a Pinocchio sequel.
I mean, it's a different Pinocchio. No, it's him. A bumblebee named Lieutenant Grumblebee is woken from his... I got my Halloween costume. Is woken from his sleep by the arrival of a large, sinister-looking ship. A man named Puppetino remarks that this is an ideal spot for a carnival. Stakes and ropes fly from the ship, and a circus tent forms, and Grumblebee hastily leaves the area. A year after being made human by the good fairy, Pinocchio, celebrating his first birthday with Mr. Geppetto, the good fairy appears and teaches Pinocchio that love is his most powerful gift. She teaches him about the mysteries of sex. So on and on from there. There's a raccoon, there's a monkey, there's more Grumblebee, there's a scalawag. Puppetino, Pinocchio, plenty of stuff going on.
Sounds like that, reminds me of that Italian restaurant that we talked about that episode. What the heck is that? Puppetino's. You know, the Italian place, the chain that we talked about.
Rick Pitino's?
Rick Pitino, oh God. Shut down.
Scott Grimes, Tom Bosley, Ed Asner, fucking slumming it as Scalawag the Raccoon. Frank wow. Welker, Jonathan Harris, James Earl Jones is the Emperor. What the fuck? Wow. Don Knotts is G. Willikers.
It's some fucking voiceover budget. Jesus
Pinocchio
Christ.
And yeah, geez, how much did they spend on this fucking thing?
$10 million. Darth Vader to Puppetino.
They spent $10 million on this thing. Oh. And it was not Disney. Okay, it was New World Pictures, so it's not even Disney, which is weird.
Okay. This made $1.6 million. It is, I can't believe it's called this. Grumble Prick Day. Up Your Ears, Puppetino. It's actually called Prick Up Your Ears.
Oh, boy.
Starring, a porn star goes back to the afterlife.
Starring Grumblebee. The film tells the story of Orton and Halliwell in a flashback framed by sequences of Lar researching a book upon which the film is based on Orton's literary agent, playwright Joe Orton, that is, Peggy Ramsey. I don't know. I already lost interest. Starring Gary Oldman, Alfred Molina, Vanessa Redgrave, Frances Barber, Julie Walters, Lindsay Duncan, Joan Sanderson. Prick up your ears.
Okay, this one made $1.19 million. Return to Horror High.
To Horror High.
Horror High. That would have made more than $1.19 million.
In 1982, the Southern California town of Crippen was rocked by a series of murders at Crippen High School, and the killer was never caught. Several years later, Cosmic Pictures, headed by sleazy producer Harry Slierick, has come to Crippen to make a movie. But this sounds very much like a movie, Scott, that I know of, taking place in Asbury Park, to make a movie about the murders. However, it seems the killer is still there. Starring Lori Leffin, Alex Rocco, Andy Romano, Maureen McCormick, George Clooney, Darcy
Maureen
DeMoss.
McCormick.
Yeah.
What's her name?
On the Brady Bunch.
Yeah. Marsha.
There you go.
And Mo Green. And Josh. Yeah, and other people. And the killer had a clown wig. Anyway, all right, this movie made 1.1... Oh, Street Smart. We did that one already. Okay. Oh, no, we didn't. Street Smart. Next one. Made 1.19 million. There's only two more. So.
Okay. Street Smart, the film. Magazine reporter Jonathan Fisher is in danger of losing his job and promises to write a hard-hitting story on prostitution. A lot of sex here to open up 87. When no one on the street
great New Year's Day movies.
When no one on the street will talk to him, he fabricates a story of a pimp that's so well received it puts his career back on track. Starring Christopher Reeve, Morgan Freeman, Kathy Baker, Mimi Rogers, Andre Gregory, and Anna Maria Horsford.
Wow.
It's a longtime pet project of Christopher Reeve. He had difficulty getting the film financed. When the Cannon Group acquired the rights of the fourth and final Superman, Reeve only agreed to do the film partly because they offered to financially back Street Smart. There you go. Received excellent reviews, but poorly at the box office. He was actually nominated. Morgan Freeman got an Academy Award and a Golden Globe nomination. Best Supporting Actor.
Wow. All right, this one made $1.53 million. It is called Three for the Road.
All right. The film centers around Paul Tracy, aide to U.S. Senator Raymond Berry, played by Raymond Berry. Paul has political aspirations of his own. He is asked to transport Robin, the senator's delinquent daughter, to an institution for girls. He has aspiring writer roommate T.S. comes along for the trip. Rob is initially drugged by her father and put unconscious in the back of a car, but as soon as she wakes up, she tries everything and anything to escape. Starring Charlie Sheen, Alan Ruck, Cary Grant, Sally Kellerman, and Blair Tefkin.
And finally, making $3.1 million that came out on this New Year's Day, a movie called White Mischief.
All right. Here we go. Let's wrap things up. With much of the rest of the world at war, a number of bored British aristocrats live dissolute and hedonistic lives in the region of Kenya colony known as Happy Valley, drinking, drugging, and indulging in decadent sexual affairs to pass the time. On January 24th, 1941, Jocelyn Hay, the philandering Earl of Errol, is found dead at his car in a remote location. The Earl had a noble pedigree, but somewhat sordid past, and a well-deserved reputation for having affairs with married women. Starring Greta Scacchi, Joss Ackland, Charles Dance, Sarah Miles, Murray Head, John Hurt, of course, the voice of the dragon from Merlin. That's for you, Chad. Hugh Grant, another appearance here. Busy man, early 87. Susan Fleetwood. And that's about it.
Okay.
Good old John Hurt.
So there was a hunk of the 30-something New Year's Day movies, or what I say, 40 or whatever, that came out on New Year's Day in 1987. And obviously there's a lot of porn and sex. So a salacious year ahead in 1987. To the NFL. We will not take the field because we're not making the picks anymore.
Yeah, I won, Kelly, by the way. Shove it.
Close, Kel, but not quite. But 1987 season is only 8 months away. But this weekend, it was divisional playoff weekend, and we will begin two games on this Saturday. The first one in Cleveland. Sorry, Mr. JR. Sorry, Mr. Greenhouse. Sad day in Cleveland. Jets had a 20-17 lead late. Look at old Bernie move the Browns down the field. Mark Moseley, the ex-Redskin, kicked the field goal and then kicked it in overtime. Browns won it 23-20.
Whatever. Bernie Jets Kosar. Are going to get revenge next week when they play the Browns. <That's true.
laughs> Bernie Kosar, 489 yards in that game. So the Jets season sadly came to an end on old Municipal
Stadium
field.
Sounds like
last
year's Jets team.
At Soldier Field in Chicago, Darryl Green ran back a punt for the go-ahead touchdown. The Redskins upset the Bears at Soldier Field. Sorry, Pete. 27-13. Then on that Sunday at Giants Stadium in the Meadowlands, the Giants throttled the San Francisco 49ers 49-3. That was the game that Jim Burt knocked Joe Montana literally like into next Christmas. LT ran back a punt for touchdown. That was also the interception for the touchdown. That's also the infamous game where second year, I believe, wide receiver Jerry Rice, he might have been a rookie, actually. I don't know if it was the second year. He caught that slant pattern, about to score a touchdown, and then for some reason he just fumbled the ball, and the ball ran perfectly symmetrical down the field into the end zone for a touchback. And that pretty much did it for the 49ers.
He then started in 85, Jerry Rice.
Okay, so this was his second year. Okay. And then finally at Mile High Stadium in Denver, the Broncos ended the season for the AFC champion Patriots, beating them 22-17. So your conference championship games the following week, the Broncos and the Browns in Cleveland, the Giants and the Redskins at the Meadowlands. So there you go.
The Red Killer.
And we will conclude the NFL season in our next podcast, because technically the season wouldn't be over yet. So in the NBA on this night, there were 7 games. Your high score for the day, guy that wore number 23, you'll hear this a lot, over 1987, 47 points as the Bulls beat the Pistons 124-119. The Knicks lost to Atlanta. And that's it. Celtics and Lakers did not play. Celtics led the Atlantic 21-9. Hawks led the Central 22-7. Mavericks led the Midwest 21-9. The Lakers led the Pacific 24-6. In the on the Frozen Pond, gentlemen, all of our teams were in action. JR, our Whalers lost 3-2 at the Civic Center to the Blackhawks. Kind of odd, since we'll be in that building shortly. Mm-hmm. Bruins beat the Islanders 5-4. D'Amato's Rangers beat Quebec 5-2. And sorry, Mr. Nelson, but your Flames lost in St. Louis 7-4 to the Blues.
Pete took a big old
shot. And finally, on this day, and this is not the last time we will hear this woman's name, but Aretha Franklin becomes the first woman
to win the Nathan's Hot Dog Eating Contest.
Gorilla might be saying that later on in the year. No, she was the first woman ever inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame on that date. But, of course, that will not be the last time we talk about Miss Aretha Franklin this year. All right. And that is your pop culture report.
All right. Well, why don't we light this candle? Been a while, yes. So why don't we go ahead and get started? Yes. This might be the latest we ever started a Vintage Vault review on the show. But here we are, of course, Scott. We are kicking off 1987, so why don't you set the stage for us?
Okay. Well, it is January 3rd, 1987 that this is being broadcast, but it was shot on December 14th, 1986, live from the Hartford Civic Center in Hartford, Connecticut. And guess who was in the building? Yours truly. And my brother and my dad took us for early Christmas gift, my first ever live show.
Wow.
So pretty cool. I'll get into it. I remember the show very, very well as well. I remember the crowd was great. We'll get into that in a little bit. Now, obviously, we weren't live. So where was the rosters on this third day of January? Well, JR, there was actually, and Kelly, a huge show at Boston Garden on this night. And actually, the roster was split 3,000 miles apart. Here are the matches at the Boston Garden on that night. Not a big crowd, though. Only 13,067. Gorilla and Lord Alfred on commentary on Nesson. So, Dan Spivey beat Jimmy Jack Funk. Don Morocco pinned Lanny Poffo. Greg Valentine beat Dick Slater. Tama pinned Scott McGee. Randy Savage defeated Bruno by countout. Might have been an interesting match. It's actually on a DVD set.
Yeah, it's a really good match, actually.
Yeah, only 6 minutes. Seems like a crime. Sika pinned Corporal Kirshner. Mike Rotundo pinned, the Duke was there because it was a Boston Garden show, so the Duke, Pete Doherty, was there. Blackjack Mulligan pinned, how about this? Blackjack Mulligan pinned Brutus Beefcake in 2 minutes.
Jeez.
We'll see that a lot in 1987, the pushing of, for some fucking stupid reason. Hillbilly Jim defeated Jim Neidhart by DQ, and Blackjack Mulligan, again, won a Bunkhouse Battle Royal by last eliminating King Kong Bundy. Other participants included, pretty much everybody on the roster. So we're going to say. So there was your Boston Garden house show on that night. The other half of the roster was 3,000 miles away, and they did 2 shows. The matinee was at the Riverside Convention Center in Riverside, California, 2,145. Iron Mike Sharp defeated Billy Anderson. Moondog Spot fought Tiger Chung Lee to a draw. Oh, poor bastard.
Oh, my God.
Pedro, look at this. Pedro Morales beat Bret Hart by DQ. Are you fucking serious?
Never ends.
You've got to be joking.
Never ends.
Thank God, only by DQ.
Tito Santana pinned Hercules, and King Harley Race defeated Coco Beware. The nightcap was at the old Oakland Coliseum. 15,534, the largest pro wrestling crowd in Northern California in 12 years.
Wow.
And it's because of this match, the opener. The Karate Kid and Little Coco defeated Little Tokyo and Lord Littlebrook. That's why. Butch guy defeated Nick Kaniski. Remember him? Jerry Allen defeated Steve Lombardi. Oh, I feel bad for this 15,000. The Honky Tonk Man defeated SD Jones. The Killer Bees defeated the Foreign Legion, Iron Sheik Nikolai. Junkyard Dog defeated Adrian Adonis by DQ. Billy Jack Haynes defeated Jake Roberts by DQ. And in the main event, Hulk Hogan successfully defended his world championship against Kamala. So there's where the roster was on this day, January 3rd. Half was in the East Coast in Boston, half on the West Coast in Northern California, Riverside and Oakland. What else do we have, JR, before we dive in? Any notes or anything?
No, I think that's it. I think we are
all
ready.
Good. All right, so let's hop in.
All right, we kick off the first show of the new year with some quick hit promos, as we're used to seeing here on Saturday's Main Event. Paul Orndorff from Bobby Heenan. We hear from Hulk Hogan, Jimmy Hart and Adrian Adonis, George Steele, and then Harley Race, and then Junkyard Dog. We then head over to Vince McMahon and Jesse Ventura opening the show, running down tonight's card. Jesse predicts that there'll be a new world champion tonight, and Vince says this is the first ever steel cage match on network television. Jesse says Bobby has taken out an insurance policy on the title, so he is super confident that his man will be taking home the gold. Mean Gene is in the back with Bobby Heenan and Paul Orndorff. Orndorff refuses to talk, so Bobby talks about the history of his feud with Hogan and the belt insurance that he has purchased. Gene then talks to Hogan, who says the steel cage is the end of the road for Orndorff, and Gene puts over Hogan's record in cages in 1986, which I think is just 1-0, but whatever. Hulk says this is the last resort between the two men, and of course that match is Hulk Hogan defending the WWF Championship against Paul Orndorff inside of a steel cage. And if you remember, these two have been feuding for quite a while, and this cage match was built up here to end their feud. Following the match, Orndorff began reducing his schedule due to an arm injury he sustained during the feud with Hogan. The two were drawing big-time money at the time, didn't want to take time off for surgery until the feud ended, and that six-month feud, one of the most profitable feuds in history of wrestling, also cost Orndorff some nerve damage, and pretty much the rest of his career, you could always tell one of his arms was smaller than the other due to atrophy issues, but... Anyway, he didn't want to cash out. Can't blame him. Big blow off to the long, intense running feud has arrived. Perfect gimmick, perfect setting, network TV, inside the cage, title on the line, opening up the year. First match we're going to see. I thought it was really well set up here. Heenan and Orndorff come out defiantly, still using Real American. Hogan power walks to the ring, usual wild atmosphere and reaction that he gets. Vince and Jesse doing a great job here, setting the stage, laying out all the ramifications, hyping things up. Orndorff attacks at the bell, beats Hogan with the bell, and then stomps away stiffly. Orndorff makes a quick go at the door, but Hogan blocks him. The challenger keeps bringing the heat as the crowd is rallying him, rallying Hogan the best they can. Orndorff almost escapes a second time, but Hogan saves it. Vince wants to know why Danny Davis is out there when he hasn't been assigned, and he's been causing trouble, as we'll see soon enough. Orndorff keeps laying in power strikes and trying to escape, with one almost working as he gets over the top and starts to drop down, but Hogan grabs him by the hair, choking him over the rail and pulls him back in while slamming his face into the steel. This is where Jesse hits his classic line, if Hulk Hogan would be champion if Mr. Wonderful were bald. Hogan lays the wood, punching away and choking Orndorff with the bandana before nearly escaping over the top. Orndorff turns the tide and goes back to work with knees and elbows, trying to escape wherever he can. The tide keeps ebbing and flowing with no slowing down. Hogan tries to go for the door, but Danny Davis has it locked, and that pisses off Vince. The two keep battling as Jesse compares this to Ali versus Frazier, saying neither man will be the same after the match. Heenan barks instructions to Orndorff, who keeps levying blows, trying to knock Hulk down long enough to get out. Both men end up hitting the steel at the same time, and they're both slow to get up and climb the cage walls. And they both do climb and escape, but they both hit the floor at the same time. We got a big argument here between everyone as the referees declare each referee that was out there declare their man the winner. Of course, Danny Davis is calling Paul Orndorff the winner. Real American fires up, which was a nice touch because now we have no clue who won since they both used the same song. Dan Davis comes over and just shoves down Joey Morella, and then Hogan throws Danny Davis around until Orndorff attacks Hogan from behind, knocking down Davis as well. Chaos is just raining down everywhere as Jesse and Vince debate what has just happened. Fink says the match was declared a tie and that it would be restarted as a result. And after a commercial break, it does restart. Orndorff batters Hulk on the floor and drags him back inside the cage to get things rolling. Orndorff keeps mauling Hulk as Danny Davis gets carted to the back. Jesse calls Vince out for bias announcing as things carry on. Hogan eventually hulks up and batters the challenger around the cage, busting him open. Hogan drops Orndorff for the backbreaker and then drops the leg. Hogan starts to escape, but Heenan comes in and grabs the leg, allowing Orndorff to recover and try to climb. Hogan shakes off Heenan and stops Orndorff and then shot Bobby Hart into the cage before escaping to win and retain his title to a huge pop. Hogan returns and beats up Heenan some more, adding fuel to their never-ending feud. I thought this whole match was really good. Really well executed, filled with hot brawling and good pacing. The mid-match tie I thought was well done too. It gave you a lot of extra intrigue and made you think maybe Orndorff does have a shot here. The finish was good and decisive with Hogan waxing both guys, Orndorff and Heenan, to put things to bed, closing out the huge epic feud. Heenan takes his lumps again, but remember, every time Hogan swats him off, he comes back with another plan, so we'll see what happens here. But for now, Hogan does it again, retains. I went 3 stars on this, Scott.
Your official time of this match is 10:42. Now, usually Wikipedia is a little vague with their time, so we'll kind of go with that. But the official time right now is 10:42. I gave this 3.5. This match was fantastic, and I very much remember the buzz in the building at that time. Obviously, 12 years old, I was pumped. I had my foam finger. My brother kept trying to, steal it and throw it out the car window, but he was a big Orndorff guy. And I remember there actually being, I'm trying to think, now that I think about it, I thought my brother was the only one who was the anti-Hogan guy, but there were actually two or three other, I mean, we were up in the crap seats, but there were some decent Orndorff fans floating around. Not a lot, but a couple. And When the two guys hit, my brother gets up, he gets on his chair, and he's literally he's getting popcorn cup, buckets thrown at him. And I give my brother a lot of credit. He generates a pretty good heel heat, but the match itself was pretty awesome. The building was hot. All the stuff with Danny Davis was great. Now, obviously, when I saw it, I didn't obviously listen to commentary. I taped it and I watched it when I got home. Vince needed to chill out with the Danny Davis stuff. I get the whole, we're trying to eventually establish this guy's a scheming worm, but he was going overboard to the point where even when Danny Davis was doing normal stuff, he was going overboard on it. And Jesse's like, "What the fuck are you talking about?" Like at sometimes, and it happens further on in the show, but definitely here, Jesse's like, "What the hell's wrong with you?" Like, he was literally, it sounded like he was getting legitimately annoyed that Vince was making stuff up. It was really funny, but more in the next couple matches than this one. Orndorff was awesome. And it's a shame that he never got a chance with the belt, but we're not going to get into that. Obviously, Hogan needed to keep it, so we're not going to go there again. But it was a great drama, and it was a well-told story. And Bobby is Bobby. Like we said, it's a great night to talk about this. He was awesome. Everything about this was awesome. Obviously, couldn't give it more than 3.5. You wanted to, just based on the histrionics and the chaos that ensued. That was a good word, JR. And the mayhem that was going on with the cage. Because we hadn't seen a lot of cages. We hadn't seen a cage since on national TV, since WrestleMania 2. And actually, that doesn't even count. That was pay-per-view and closed circuit. And Vince says at the beginning of the show that this is the first steel cage title match on network TV. I don't know if it's ever, obviously. He's being a little kayfabe-ish there, but just everything about it was great. Great way to start the show. Crowd's hot. Hogan won. I remember we were going crazy, and it was a great moment for Hogan. I think it vindicated him for this feud. But Orndorff deserves a boatload of credit because he was fantastic in this feud and carried his end of the bargain. 3.5 stars for me for the match. I would love to give it more. Great culmination of the feud because obviously, we have something else on the horizon. Hogan needed to, they needed to end this now, and they did, and they ended it very well. Tremendous effort by everybody involved, Kel.
Oh yeah, I mean it's one of the most memorable matches of the era. I mean, for years afterwards, my friend, me and my friends, we would talk about, we'd always reference this one as, you know, something that we love from this time. And I've seen it a million times. I had it taped off NBC when it aired, and watched it again and again for years. And yeah, I probably haven't seen it in quite a while. And watching it this morning, I was pleasantly surprised that it's held up, and I enjoyed it as much this time as I did the first time I watched it. I really, really like this. It's one of the peaks of the 80s boom, and it's one of Hogan's signature victories, one of his signature matches. Perfect end to the feud, satisfying conclusion, great stuff with the tie. That's what made it so memorable, was the whole tie thing. They hadn't done that before, and they really milked that up. They bring in Danny Davis, who they were trying to get over as a heel referee here, and had been doing that for months. And yeah, Vince, you know, he gives the hard sell, but I think it pays off in the end, because, you know, Danny Davis did get over as a heel, and it was a big deal, at least initially, when he turned heel. Yeah, Orndorff was really good. Hogan's really good. The heat was amazing. Vince and Jesse on commentary are great here, arguing constantly, and then throughout the whole show, they're great, just bickering. This was one of their signature performances, I would argue. Yeah, I mean, the match is kind of shortened as far as what you get in the ring. They go quickly to the finish, or at least the first finish. And yeah, but I mean, like, you can't replicate this whole drama here. It was so well done. Heenan, of course, is involved too. Like, there were so many guys involved in making this work and making this memorable. The ending, when they got back in the cage, I really liked. It was a decisive victory for Hogan. Rammed Orndorff into every side of the cage multiple times. Orndorff was finally busted open, which at the time was becoming pretty rare to see blood on TV, especially on Saturday's main event. I don't think that happened very often. And he gives him the leg drop too, even more decisive. Heenan gets involved, and he gets his just desserts. Huge pop for the win. Hogan goes and celebrates with some fans there. They replayed this a couple times, and there's this teenage girl that's just losing her shit over it, and she has a Hogan LGN figure in her hands, and it's just a great moment. Hogan was at the peak of his powers here. Just a very awesome complete package of angle, you know, storytelling. Even the work was really good, and it was the blow off to a long feud on NBC. Huge match. I overrated 1986, so maybe I'm gonna overrate this match. I went 4 stars.
Oh wow,
on it. It's
wow,
a class.
Cool.
It's like the whole package, you know. It's a classic match. It's like I said, one of the signature moments of the era. And I was, like I said, pleasantly surprised how much this held up watching it earlier today, and how much I was entertained by it. I think it's something you could show to non-fans and they would get sucked into it, you know, because it tells a great story. It clearly makes you hate people like Danny Davis, hate Bobby Heenan, and Hogan's the ultimate hero. It's just really great pro wrestling. I've said enough praise here. I guess
Sky, you were there, obviously, more watching at the time, but like, was Orndorff, did he feel like believable at this point still? Like, I mean, did it seem like he could possibly win the title from Hulk Hogan here in early 87?
Yes. Yeah. But I think this was it. I think after that point, we kind of knew. Because, well, you know, obviously we were watching everything. We were watching all the local stuff. And at this point, New Year, I think this was, you know, because back in the day, the cage was the blow off. So he wasn't winning this match. He was done.
Yeah.
So
and he was done. I mean, he was left off WrestleMania 3.
Which is crazy. Still crazy.
Yeah. So there you go. Hulk Hogan retains the World Wrestling Federation Championship in an excellent
fitting blow off. For sure. All right, we head backstage. where Mean Gene recaps the long winding feud between Randy Savage and George Steele, talks to Savage and Liz. Gene says Steele has a surprise plan tonight, and Savage cuts off Liz and says that nobody cares about her. Savage tells Liz to leave and then threatens to slap Gene's face and push him into a wall. Gene then talks to Steele about a surprise, but of course we get no information here. And this is the continuation of the seemingly never-ending feud between Randy Savage and George Animal Steele for the Intercontinental title. Started way back at the beginning of 86. Still going on. New contender to the IC title and feud, of course, had developed. On November 22nd, Ricky Steamboat challenged Randy Savage for the title. Steamboat lost the match via countout. It was attacked further by Savage, who took the ring bell and jammed it into Steamboat's throat, clashing his larynx. Steamboat makes his return from injury here to prevent Steele from suffering a similar injury at the hands of Randy Savage. We'll talk about that in a moment. Another installment. This feud has eaten up all of 1986, leaking into 87. Savage's entrance is great as always, a mix of regality and extreme confidence. Vince plays up Steele's surprise, and Steele carries an action figure out as a gift for Liz, which Jesse mocks as a terrible surprise. Liz is torn as always, and Savage takes the figure and spikes it. Steele attacks from behind and hoists him high into a choke before dropping him to the mat. Steele mauls Savage with a flurry as Jesse bitches out the referee and says Steele should be suspended. Steele then calls to the back, but nobody comes out. Savage attacks from behind and chokes and flails away with strikes. Savage slams Steele and heads up top, and then the real surprise emerges. Ricky Steamboat comes out, starts jawing with Savage. Steele slams Savage off the top and sends him flying over the top rope hard to the floor. As Steamboat cheers on his friend, Savage is laying in a heap. Steele scoops up Liz and carries her to the back, as Jesse says this is conspiracy and kidnapping. Savage gets in the ring, and Steamboat gets forced to the back by officials. After a break, Savage is waiting in the ring, and Steamboat reemerges, but the two are kept apart. Savage finally returns and tore up the turnbuckle and shoves it. I'm sorry, Steele returns, tears at the buckle, shoves it in Macho's face. Jesse's still ranting about suspensions, and Steele is all over Savage with his nonsense offense. Savage is able to shove Steele hard to the corner off a headlock. Jesse wonders how thrown off Savage is with Liz missing. Savage keeps pelting away until Steele lands a boot to the gut and some punches. Steele keeps biting Savage and uses a foreign object from his tights before shoving him outside again. Steele chucks the ref across the ring, but Savage grabs the bell, sneaks in the ring, and clubs Animal in the back of the head for the win. Steamboat ran out back to protect Steele, but Savage bolts to the back. Steamer nurses Animal back to health in a weird spot. He's rubbing his chest and sprinkling turnbuckle foam over him like fairy yeah. dust. This was really interesting and chaotic. I like the Steamboat stuff a lot. It added the fuel to the fire. Steele is Steele. Wasn't as bad here, but it lagged on late in the match. I thought right after the break they could have wrapped this thing. I thought the back end of it just really kind of dragged. Steele is fine as a tool in the feud, but he needs to just not be the focus anymore. Like, now it's Steamboat Savage. Steele is just kind of in the background. We need to be done with him being the focused part of the feud with Savage. So I went one star, which is basically like six for a Steele match. So I'll give him that. But a lot of this has to do with the heat around Steamboat and some of the brawling early on, Kelly.
Yeah, well, the Hogan-Orndorff cage match I've seen numerous times since it happened. But this one I don't know if I've seen since the 80s. So this was, you know, I remembered parts of it, but this was, you know, pretty refreshing or new to me almost. And I like this quite a bit. It was very similar to the Hogan-Orndorff match in that it was there was a lot of story, a lot of spectacle, angle. You know, the match in the ring wasn't as important as to what was going on outside the ring. And I really got caught up in it, and the crowd was red hot. I mean, say what you will about Steele, the feud was over with the public. I mean, it didn't produce the best matches or anywhere close to the best matches, but it was really over. And when Steele died, I mean, that was something that was mentioned a ton, was his feud with Savage, and it was something that really resonated with the public, the whole Beauty and the Beast thing. And they play it up great here. Elizabeth, who looked, you know, particularly stunning this evening, you know, he brings the doll out to her, takes her back later. I mean, it's all good. Steamboat making his dramatic return was super cool. Unfortunately, the music on the network dubbed in is not super cool. It's horrible. I don't know where they got that from. It's just dreadful, dreadful dub job there. And then we get back. Steele, of course, with the turnbuckle padding. The crowd is just batshit through this whole match. Vince and Jesse are great. arguing through it. And I love at the end when Savage wins, Jesse just so happy. He's like, yes. Because Savage is one of his boys. And he took a lot of pride in Savage winning this one. It plays up the long-running feud. It's still not over. It plays up the Steamboat feud that it got hot and Steamboat, you know, the whole injury thing with the ring bell was a pretty big deal at the time. I remember it was one of the first times I really felt like terrified almost watching wrestling was when that angle happened. And him coming back here, that was a huge moment. It's setting up things now for WrestleMania 3. And, it's maybe not the best in-ring stuff, but as far as, like, achieving all the goals to make you want to see more of this and to make you anticipate what was coming forward, this was an A-plus in that regard. I gave it 2 stars. I'm on a high with this show because I'm coming off all those damn MSG shows, and I didn't even see that last one you did with Pete, which was apparently abysmal. but seeing a Saturday's main event, it just makes you realize like how different the presentation of the shows were, and how, you know, Saturday's main event was all about you got to, you know, hook the viewers in, you got to get good ratings. I mean, you can't just put out crappy Pedro Morales and CV Offie matches. You got to put out the good stuff, and we're getting really high end WWF entertainment on this show. And yeah, I just 2 matches in, I was like so happy. I remembered why I loved WWF wrestling again after the MSG shows almost, you know, had beaten it out of me in the last few months. But yeah, I thought this was great fun.
I gave this a star. Your official match time, 8:30. First off, Savage's promo is great. I love that he called Mean Gene a Jughead. I thought that was awesome, because Mean Gene is. Steamboat, I remember that night. I thought the Hogan pop was good. Watching this again, I remember the building. Yeah. Steamboat pop was off the fucking charts. And no, it was not that trash theme, Kelly, which, by the way, is like the official Steamboat dub theme. That's not the first time they use that. I think they use it later on in the year as well. It's atrocious. It's awful music. But when he comes out, the place goes insane. Because you knew, we knew it. We knew that. I mean, even back then, we knew that Steamboat Savage was the feud we were about to start seeing. I don't think there's any doubt about that. We saw because I remember seeing a couple of later on that year some MSG some New Haven Coliseum matches with that. And it was just, you knew it was coming. So we were like kind of, I was not a big George Steele fan back then. I'm certainly not now. And I think we knew that Steamboat was the next guy. But yeah, this was the match I was more referring to earlier when I was talking about Vince sounding like an utter buffoon, overselling this Danny Davis stuff. I think it's Savage is tied in the ropes. This might be more with the next match, but I thought I remember this. Savage is tied in the ropes, and Danny Davis pushes George Animal Steel away. And Vince is like, look at what Danny Davis is doing. He's pushing George Steel away. And Jesse's like, because Savage is tied in the ropes. Like, you wanted Jesse to just say dumbass at the end of it. Like, Vince was just going way overboard with the selling of Danny Davis to the point where he sounded like a complete idiot. I know we accused Gorilla of that.
I don't know, but I feel like I just feel like they're in hyperdrive to get the Davis thing over. I mean, we're right on the brink of everything going down. So I kind of get the oversell here. I think he's really trying to hammer. And don't forget, I think we have to look at this differently sometimes with Saturday's main event. It's not always like aimed toward the standard crowd, right? So I think he's really trying to hammer home for anyone who's just tuning in on NBC, maybe new to the product, without outright saying that he's a heel and he's like. We have to let them all know that Danny Davis is kind of a shitbag as a human. So I think that's what he's trying to really hammer. Like, the commentary on the Saturday's main events overall tend to be more, more beat over your head, hammer it
no,
in
you're right.
kind of thing.
Sell jobs. No, yeah. You're right. That's a good point. I agree with that. No, I concur with that point. The match itself is shit. I agree with you, JR, that they could have cut this about 3 minutes. However, Kelly, I like your point about, again, the whole package. Savage is just awesome. And like I said earlier in the show when we were recapping 86, Savage is a guy that everyone knows is a crown jewel of this company. And even more so than 1986, you will most definitely see it in 1987, and it starts here. Just being a great heel. You know, everybody loves Elizabeth, and he hates that George Steele, he hates George Steele for liking Elizabeth. Meanwhile, he tells Elizabeth, no one cares what you think. Shut up and move. You know, like, shut up, Jughead. Like, I can't give the Savage promo justice. It was so fucking great. But I'm done with George Steele. I'm done with it. we can move on to Steamboat now and actually have a good feud going here. Because everyone knew how good both wrestlers were. So even in 1987, in the standards of not really thinking about the term work rate, we knew that Savage Steamboat was going to be were going to be great matches. Can we just get to that now and cut the fucking shit with the dolls and the turnbuckle padding and just all that nonsense? Can we move on from that and get to something really, really good? Something with the real teeth in it? I think that's another thing that I think sadly has held Savage back. Is this Steel feud is just shit. I would have been happy with 10 months of Tito and just gotten rid of this garbage. I think it would have been pretty awesome. But any event, Savage, and you're right, Kelly, he's got like the, when he does the count, he goes, yes, yes, that's what I'm talking. Like he was almost like he was watching it at home, you know?
It was
awesome. Nah, Savage retains his Intercontinental Championship in a, you know, typical match with George Steele, but a lot of storytelling, a lot of psychology, and the return from the larynx injury of Ricky Steamboat. And of course, they had the awesome vignettes where he's trying to pretend to talk and he's like, it's like, it's fucking ridiculous. More with Savage and the Steamer as we move along, Jer.
For sure. All right. Mean Gene is with Bobby Heenan and Harley Race as we see clips of the coronation of the king. Race says he is the king of all wrestling and all will bow down to him, and he forces Gene to bow. Gene says JYD won't bow, but Heenan vows that he will. Gene then talks to Junkyard Dog, who laughs off the idea of bowing for anyone, says the U.S. has never had a king or queen, and he only bows to the Lord. And that, of course, brings us to the Junkyard Dog taking on King Harley Race. On December 13th at the Philadelphia Spectrum, Harley Race and the Dog fought to a double countout. Both men started brawling on the floor. JYD went after Bobby Heenan on the apron. Race attacked him from behind. And, of course, the feud would roll on to here. Race and Heenan head out, Jesse putting over his regality. And again, this is another thing, Scott, like we talked about, kind of hammering over the head, really letting everyone know that Harley Race is the king. Even though we all kind of know it, this is the first time we're seeing it on NBC, so that's really being put out front and center. JYD marches out to a big pop, but Jesse says the crowd is favoring the Dog, won't bother the king at all. And back to that Sinus Main Event point, too. I do like how they almost treated it like its own universe. Like, they have to catch you up on everything since the last Saturday's Main Event. Not since, like, recent. Like, it almost exists. They cater so uniquely to the viewer that may only be watching this, and they really fill in the gaps between the shows. I thought that was well done at the time. Vince is annoyed that the biased Danny Davis was reffing this match. Heenan demands that JYD bow, but instead he turns around and shows his ass. Race lands a cheap shot on JYD to open up and works him over with strikes, grabbing a near fall. Race lands a high knee to the face as Vince says Race is the most scientific wrestler in the world today. Race drops a hard knee to the face for two. JYD turns the tide and whips Harley to the corner and yanks him off the ropes, which pisses off Jesse, who says that's illegal. Race goes to the eyes and hits the belly to belly. Race tries to headbutt, but it backfires, and Vince says it was a stupid attack, of course, the hard head of JYD. JYD pelts Race with his own headbutts and then shoots him hard into the corner and over the top to the floor. Heenan checks on Race as the crowd is all over him. JYD grabs the robe and crown and puts it on and prances around the ring. Heenan comes in and slugs JYD, but JYD shakes it off and drills Brain with the right hand. Race heads up top and clobbers the Dog from behind and keeps working him over until the bell rings. Vince is all over Davis for allowing this nonsense and not controlling the attack. JYD wins by DQ via the announcement, but Davis just watches as Heenan and Race force JYD to bow to the king. The Dog fights to his feet and fights off both men until Davis stops him. JYD levels Davis with a headbutt and then helps him to the back. The match was nothing at all, pure angle, with some good heat. It was definitely poorly executed, but that was part of the awkwardness of Davis kind of allowing everything. Like, that was part of the story in there as well. Fine segment, nothing match. I win a half a star, Scott.
I gave this, let me see, I gave it a half star as well. there is nothing left of the Junkyard Dog. There really isn't. His in-ring work is just is absolutely brutal. And I mean, I'm watching right now some of the 82 Mid-South stuff, and it's amazing how difference 5 years makes. I mean, it seems like a lot, but other guys didn't lose it that bad in 5 years, but he's just a disaster. Harley, on the other hand, and I remember being a big Harley Race fan. I knew Harley a lot back then. What a great character this was. I mean, the Gorilla's right, though. The little, he mentions it on Primetime Off, and the stupid, like, rubber band on the crown. It does look pretty moronic, but, you know, considering how advanced, you know, he was in his 40s, I think we looked it up at that point, Harley, that he was still pretty good in the ring, but JYD is just trash. And this match and the next match, you can tell, are just the beginnings of things to come. These were, unlike the title matches with Hogan and Savage, those were ending feuds. These were definitely just tastes to whet our appetite for what could be, what's to come. So you kind of knew that there wasn't much to go on here. 6 minutes your time. More Danny Davis stuff from Vince, but that's fine. Like I said, JR, you're right. They're trying to kind of make it. But it's almost, but I mean, Jesse is getting this tone in his voice like, oh my God, he's just going way overboard on this. But he was going with it, which is why Jesse's so great. Again, Dog and Pony Show to keep the storyline going. Not much more to say. I gave it half a star, Kel. It was okay. But sadly, Junkyard Dog is just so shot right now.
Yeah, no, he doesn't have much left. I mean, the two of these guys could have had a really, you know, crazy brawl in an earlier time, probably, maybe in Mid-South in the early 80s. But, you know, I'm going to continue to overrate these matches. I mean, I only gave it a star and not a half star.
It is overrated.
But it was entertaining. I mean, I was totally into the whole thing. And I remember not being too into this feud at the time, but this was fun. Vince sure loved the whole common man versus wealthy, powerful person storyline. Like, he would come back to that quite often and use it again and again. He really loved to book that whole thing where the common man had to rise up against some wealthy, powerful person. And so we're getting that here. Jesse and Vince continue to be on a roll all night. The crowd is hot for this one again. Like, we're getting just one big hot match after the next. JYD was still super over, one of the top baby faces. The crowd loved him. When he put on the robe and crown, the crowd just went nuts. Heenan took a great bump in this one. Or no, Race took a great bump over the top rope. He still looks really good, as you said, Scott. Heenan gets involved again. You know, he was, at this time, he managed so many guys and so many top guys. He was involved in so much stuff.
And a Race just almost feels like like spoils for him, you know what I mean? Like, to have him as well, it's like, God, another, right. like he needs this guy too, right? He's so loaded at his stable. It's just like, yeah, just spoiled.
That's true, yeah. But they fit perfectly.
Oh, yeah, it's a great fit.
Yeah, it was, I think they had no choice.
It almost feels unfair to the other managers. Yeah. He's got these guys.
Yeah. But, I mean, it was, Heenan was, you know, a notch above everybody else on the manager food chain, for sure. He was the main event manager at the time.
Yeah.
Davis, this progresses the Davis storyline. Like, everything, like, these shows are so well booked, where the MSG shows are just randomness, you know. Of course, some you get blow-offs at the MSG shows. You get a few, you know, angles and progressions of storylines. But these Saturday night main event shows are just, you know, there's no waste. Nothing's wasted here. Everything has a purpose.
So much energy, too. Just flies around. The energy, just everything about it is.
Yeah.
Just, yeah.
I think it's, you know, the NBC influence. You know, they had a clear vision of what makes good television. And, you know, I think they reined in a lot of, like, Vince's maybe bad habits. I don't know. I mean, they gave it more focus, I think. And I think that influence then was something that the WWF continued to use after, you know, in years after the relationship between the two of them ended.
Yeah, they definitely learned a lot, you can tell.
Yeah, yeah, they learned a lot about, like, world-class TV, basically, or top-flight television production from NBC. And, yeah, I mean, this is like a match like this. If this had happened on the MSG show, we would have probably given it a dud or whatever. But, yeah, I think it's because it's given a bigger stage and more focus, it's more entertaining. And it's setting up something else for WrestleMania 3. Yeah, yeah. It's fun enough for what it is, for sure.
All right. So we head backstage where Paul Orndorff is flipping out. Bobby Heenan calmly says he'll fix this and proves to Jack Tunney that Orndorff is champion. He vows that in less than 1 month, Orndorff will have the gold. Gene comes in and Orndorff says he's took the fight to Hogan. The camera don't lie. Heenan calms everyone down, says we're going to bring the footage to Tunney. So weird, he says less than a month. What was less than a month away that they were? It feels like they were like leading to something with that date, you know what I mean? It's odd the way they really fixate on less than a month. In less than 1 month, you'll be champion. Gene is with Adrian Adonis and Jimmy Hart. They talk about the arm injury, courtesy of Roddy Piper's crutch. Adonis says he can take a licking and keep on ticking, and he's going to whip on Piper. Gene doesn't think it's prudent to allow him back in the ring, but Hart says Adrian's all heart. He can't be kept away. Gene is with Piper, says Adonis has been humiliated him, but he learns from his mistakes and he'll always get back up. Piper is angry and it's eating him up inside. He isn't fighting for money, he's fighting for pride. And that does take us to Roddy Piper taking on Adrian Adonis. Feud at full boil. If you remember back on November 29th, Adonis made his return after being taken out by Piper's crutch, attacked Piper with a crutch of his own, and proceeded to put him in a sleeper hold. That brings us to the match here. Jesse says you can't judge a book by its cover based on how Adrian survived that attack and recovered so quickly. Vin says Adonis isn't what he seems. Piper heads out to a huge pop, is all fired up. Jesse says Piper might be fighting for pride, but Adonis is fighting for revenge. Adonis taunts Piper, but Roddy tosses his kilt on Adrian's head and attacks as Vin says this isn't the first time a skirt's been on the head of Adonis. That even cracks up Jesse. Piper mauls Adonis, tossing him around the ring and sending him careening outside with a running knee lift. Adonis comes back in, and Piper keeps battering him from corner to corner as Jesse says Vince is losing his voice from rooting so hard for his favorites all night. Vince reveals that Liz has been released from Steele's custody. Piper works the arm as Vince says, "Would you have mercy, Jesse?" Which makes me think of Full House. Adonis goes to the eyes and batters Roddy in the corner, scratching his back as well. Piper makes a quick comeback and shoves Adonis to the mat, but Adonis catches a sleeper. Piper leverages them both to the floor to break the hold. They brawl there until Jimmy gets in the mix. Piper slugs him, but Adonis squirts Piper in the eyes with a cologne and then rolls to the outside of the ring to win by count out. Adonis and Jimmy leave as Piper tries to shake things off. Another quick brawl, really all purely angle advancement. Piper is red hot. Adonis has returned to some good feisty anger. Far from over with this feud. Another nothing match, all angle. Again, half a star for in the ring, but you know, more heat, more build, building to the eventual blow off with these two guys. What'd you think of this one, Kelly?
Yeah, you know, it was very similar to the previous match. I mean, yet another hot match, four straight now. All of these, you know, could have been like the main event of the show, really. And yeah, it was a typical high energy Piper brawl, but yeah, it was just, it wasn't meant to go very long. It was all just, yeah, let's get this. Because Adonis had been gone for a while, and so they needed to sort of reheat this feud. That's basically all this was all about. And yeah, I went a star. I mean, I thought it was pretty much on par with the previous match. Not much to it other than, like you said, JR angle advancement. So yeah, one star sounds about right.
I gave it a half star, like JR did. And yeah, it's almost a mirror image of the previous match. Again, just like the last one, we're looking at a prelude to something bigger down the line. As a matter of fact, I almost am kind of glad from a roundabout perspective that Adonis has been gone for a while because this feud didn't get old.
Mm.
So knowing that they needed, you know, that they wanted it to continue on for, you know, the next couple of months, that Adonis was gone for a while and Piper was able to work other stuff, worked with his boy Orton, worked with Morocco. And then when Adonis came back, we can kind of rejuvenate this and it's not stale. So as much as you don't want to see Adonis get hurt or canned, it did kind of help him and the company that this feud didn't get old. Otherwise, that's about it. A lot of, you know, histrionics, typical Piper match where there's not much going on in the middle of the ring. They do the whole thing at the end with the, you know, the atomizer to the face and everything. Not much more to say. More to come from them, mostly because of great interview segments on house shows and superstars and challenge from now till, you know, when we get to the big show. Yeah, that's pretty much it. Not much more to say here. Piper's fired up. Mm-hmm. That Pride promo is one of his most famous.
Yeah, it's a good one.
Yeah, we're ready for more from these two guys. This was just a taste, a prelude, more to come.
Yeah, that's a good point about Adonis taking the time off. This not getting burnt through or burnt out. You're right. They were able to keep it chugging along and keep it moving. So I think it's a really good point. It definitely kept the feud fresh and set them up. You wonder if it could have had legs to march if he hadn't left for that stretch. So
I wonder. I do wonder.
I mean, they probably would have.
I mean, he could have been. But. I mean, he could have been in the background still working with Orton in Morocco. Right. But I don't know. I'm wondering if just Adonis on TV would have still fried it. You know.
Yeah, I think they would have stretched it, but it probably wouldn't have felt as fresh. So I think you're right. But I think it's still. I think they would have made it last. But all right, we go backstage. Mean Gene is with Hulk Hogan celebrating his win. Gene tells Hulk of Bobby's plan to go talk to Tunney. Hogan says he's beaten him twice, and Orndorff has never beaten the champ. Gene says Bobby can't be trusted, and who knows what will happen in Tunney's office. We then head to our final match of the night as Black Jack Mulligan makes his return, taking on Jimmy Jack Funk. Of course, we saw Mulligan back in December, closed out the MSG show. Quick filler here, dubbed the Battle for Texas. Jimmy Jack still just meandering around, doing nothing. Mulligan ambles out to a nice reaction. Just a big dude with a solid look, pretty old in general. The pajama top is also an odd choice. I never really got that. Jimmy Jack demands Mulligan take off his spurs, and he obliges. Finn says Piper's having discomfort and blindness, but it's temporary. We get an instant interview with Gene and Mulligan talking about the Battle of Texas and his big New Year's Eve party that he goes on and on about. Jimmy Jack attacks, but Mulligan shrugs it off and makes quick work of the insane one. Another pointless match, no angle really, just a squash to fill a time to close the show, as we usually see on these Saturday's main events. So I went big old Dutta Rooney on this one, Scott.
Yeah, I mean, it's evident that Blackjack Mulligan's probably broke and needs some money because there's no business for him being in the ring right now. The match is shit. He's not selling anything. It's garbage. There's no need for him to be here.
He's just old and sloppy looking.
Yeah, he obviously is hurting for cash, Kel. Otherwise, why would he even be here?
Well, don't forget, he came back as one of the machines, so he's been around back here for since the summer. Right. So
crazy.
Yeah, he hasn't mastered the art of counterfeiting money yet, like he would in a few years.
Kendall's building machines in the basement.
Yeah, I guess he didn't really master that art either, because he ended up in the clink because of it. Yeah, Mulligan, God, he was. I don't think he was that terribly old, but he was definitely
not. Feels it. He looks it.
Yeah, not in the best of shape. And he wouldn't last too much longer in this role. Johnny Soro tells the story of going to a show at the Spectrum around this time when he was wrestling in the full pajama gear. And, you know, under the hot lights, Johnny said he looked like he was going to have a heart attack. He was just, you know, pouring sweat. And breathing very heavy. And, it probably was quite warm to wrestle in that goddamn outfit.
It looked awful. It looked sloppy and stupid, too. Just give him a fucking T-shirt, you know, whatever.
Well, yeah, I mean, I think they were trying to cover up his physique, obviously. But, yeah.
But he wore the singlet as the machines he looked at, right? I don't know. It's stupid.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, I don't know. Someone, maybe it was I don't want to say it was a rib, but maybe it was a rib. Who knows? I really dislike Jimmy Jack Funk. I think he's garbage. Yes. This was just short and nothing. Although Mulligan's back elbow finish looked not too bad. I always like
Jimmy Jack sold it pretty well too.
Yeah, yeah. So I almost gave it a half star for that, but no, I'll I'll go with Dud as well. I would never want to see these two guys wrestle again.
All right, let me read some quick feedback, and then we'll do our awards so I don't forget. And our buddy Steve Bennett here brings back – I mean, this is like we're going old school with the length of this thing. So here we go. A few years back, I was interviewing David Shoemaker, and we were looking back at the wrestling of our youth. He said something I thought was really smart. He said, wrestling exists in people's past. This is wrestling to me. In my past, I was a six-year-old boy in Buffalo, New York, trying so hard to keep my eyes open until the last bell. I don't think Hogan was even in the ring, and I had already fallen asleep. But the VCR did the work for me, and I woke up and watched the show over and over until it was time for the next syndicated show that day. This is an incredible episode of Saints Main Event. The classic cage match at the beginning was booked so slickly, with two referees, so one can be on both sides of the cage for the finish. Both wrestlers came out to the same song, so when it played after, the false finish didn't tip off. Hogan and Orff did a great job of actually tying. Hogan went over, and Heenan took some bumps. Savage bullying Liz in the pre-tape was Gene was classic heel work, and easily my favorite match in the never-ending feud between these two. The return of Steamboat is electric. I hate watching the version on the network as he has a fake music mutes the pop. At least she's in the arms of someone who cares about her. The crowd is so electric all night, buzzing energy brought a suspense to all the action. It sort of felt like Game 7 of the Whalers versus Canadians in an Adams Division playoff series. Vince is peak Vince, and Jesse's awesome. I love this show. Every match bringing us closer to WrestleMania 3. The Brain realizes Orndorff's not going to get him the championship, so what's next? Steamboat's back, and Savage has to deal with it. JYD won't bow for the king. This is more Doctor than Nixon's Watergate tapes. Adonis versus Piper. More progress towards WrestleMania 3. Adonis is such an awesome bumper. Vince says Elizabeth has been released from protective custody. Amazing. The crowd's electric. Piper has bad breath. He's counted out. This won't be the last time these guys battle. The question is, can Morelli even count to 10? Piper's selling the hell out of the perfume in the eyes. Someone should have shown the tape to Warrior before he got in the ring at Rumble 89. Hogan's red jacket is fire. Maybe the Battle of Texas should have been saved for another night, or maybe never. But nothing's perfect. That female ref is a Hartford 6 3/4. Good news. Piper's blindness is only temporary. And just an amazing show. I can't wait to listen to the shows as we get closer and closer to WrestleMania. Thank you, Steve. That was great. Kevin Jeffrey. Were the tag titles just an afterthought at this point? Was it more Dynamite Kid's health? As for the show, it does set up matches for Mania. Orndorff goes from working the main event to being absent for that show. Tag titles are interesting. We touched on it last month, Scott. I guess we can talk about it as we move along here week to week. But they do feel like they're more important with the Dream Team. I do feel like since the Bulldogs won them, they haven't felt as revered or well used. And I know part of that is Dynamite's health, but we'll touch on that as we move forward.
Well, the interesting thing is that the back injury to Dynamite and Hamilton actually happened the night before this show was taped.
Interesting.
So yeah, that would be the end of his run, basically, because then he would be subbed out for the rest of the run until the title switch.
Which is weird, because I feel like the titles weren't used as much even when he was healthy then. So I don't know what was going on. Maybe it was this MSG. We didn't see as much. Or even when they did, it felt like they weren't. Maybe it was a lack of heel contenders more than anything. I don't know. Because even then you get a lot of like, you know, Sheik and Volkov. There was another one that was kind of a crap team thrown together. You know, like they got a lot of that kind of stuff.
Yeah. The Funks without the Jimmy Jack Funk version.
Right. They haven't really had like a meaty feud, you know? Yeah, the Moondogs.
No, they didn't have a meaty feud. And they never went with Stud and Bundy on any of the televised shows, which could have been a very interesting match, you know, visually the big against small sort of thing. That could have been something that would have been interesting.
Here's the official description from Graham, December 13th, 1986, Cops Coliseum. WWF Tag Team Champions Davey Boy Smith and Dynamite Kid defeat Don Morocco and Bob Orton at 13:42 when Smith pinned Orton after the Morocco accidentally hit his partner with Mr. Fuji's cane. Midway through the contest, Dynamite sustained a serious back injury when he ran the ropes and received a knee to the back from Morocco. Following the incident, Smith worked the remainder of the match by himself. After the bout, Dynamite was assaulted with a chair until Smith cleared Morocco and Orton from ringside. Moments later, Dynamite was taken backstage on a stretcher. So it's all Morocco's fault.
Always.
According to that, anyway.
All right,
I think it was actually when he was jumping like on a drop-down spot, like mid-jump his back.
Yeah, that's what I think it was, too. Yeah.
Yeah.
Just crumbled from all the steroids. Yeah. All right, Taylor Keehy, a couple of questions. I know the shows were taped weeks before. They advertised the Saturday Night Event tapings, Scott. Were they? Or were they just pimped house shows? You were there.
No, they were... Let me think.
And the banner's there, right?
Yeah, the banner's there. No, I'm pretty sure I remember it was a, I knew it was a Saints main event.
Okay.
I'm pretty sure it said it on the ticket.
Was that Reader Chatterton reffing the last match? Yes, it was. Any thoughts on that situation? I think we've talked about it before. We definitely did in our network adventure TNTs. Yeah, I mean, it is what it is. I had never had a problem with a female ref. Obviously, you know, probably was the wrong time period in the old boys club to try it, given what happens after. Mm. It was fine.
I thought she was gone by this point already, actually.
She must have left maybe late 86. Maybe this was one of her last things, possibly.
Yeah.
Well, here's what we got before the cameras rolled. Tito fought Morocco to a 15-minute draw. Jose Luis Rivera pinned Iron Mike Sharp. I can't believe I sat through this.
Oh, wow.
Hart Foundation. I must have taken a shit during that one. Hart Foundation defeated the new U.S. Express at 11-minute mark. Herc pinned Pedro Morales. There you go. I got to see a Pedro Morales loss, Kelly. Suck it.
Oh, wow.
And SD Jones was pinned by a newcomer who we'll talk about down the line. So we had five matches before the – oh, I'm sorry. And Honky pinned Kolber Kirshner.
Hot show.
And then, And then we had – and then the cameras rolled. So.
All right. As it goes without saying, Jesse was on fire, easily the best reason to watch these old TVs. And finally, Brian Bayless. Not much of a standalone show besides Hogan Orndorff. The action was forgettable. However, it did set things in motion for WrestleMania. And why are they trying to push Blackjack Mulligan in 1987? So I think we touched on that. All right. Let's quickly go through our awards. It's been a long night here on the Place to Be podcast. Covered a lot of ground. So why don't we go ahead and wrap things with those awards, the first of 87. Our match of the night, to me, pretty easy choice. I went with Hogan Orndorff.
Oh, it's a cage match, no doubt about it.
Yeah, obviously.
No doubt. Yeah, no doubt.
All right, let me mark that down. Our Hogan Award for our MVP, I went with Bobby Heenan. I thought he was fantastic on promos all night. I thought he was involved in all the big matches. He bumped around in the cage. He was the stir that stirred the drink. The straw that stirred the drink on this night. What did you guys think?
You missed a...
MVP.
You put the Hogan Orndorff match in the wrong column. So.
Oh, I skipped the worst match. All right, we'll come back to it.
You skipped the shit match.
Okay.
Definitely Bobby. He was top flight. He was all over the show. Definitely Bobby. Kel.
I considered Bobby, but I went with Vince and Jesse on commentary.
Really?
I thought this was one of their best performances. They were great in every match, pretty much, getting over everything, arguing, being humorous. I was really thoroughly entertained by them throughout the evening.
All right. Our cousin Junior, the worst match of the night. I went with another easy choice, Mulligan versus Funk.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Yep.
All right, our Uncle Elmer for the LVP, the worst work of the night. I went with George Steele on this one because fuck him. What'd you guys have?
Yeah, he was bad, and I agree. Blackjack Mulligan was just plodding and terrible, but it's hard to give it him that because at least his finisher looked halfway decent, so I'll give it to George Steele, too.
Oh, jeez, you guys are so harsh. I went with Jimmy Jack
Funk.
Yeah,
you're Jimmy Jack Funk.
You and Jimmy Jack
Funk. Obviously the worst worker.
You're the worst worker. All right, so best moment, I went with Steamboat's surprise return. I think there's a couple choices here. I mean, there's a couple within Hogan Orndorff alone. Piper's promo, everything. But Steamboat's return is such a big deal, setting up WrestleMania. It was really well done, so that was my choice. What do you guys think?
Mine too. Yep,
I agree.
Okay. And finally, the RCD Award for the most juiced on the night. Not a ton of juice flowing on this night. I went with Hogan, kind of the go-to when we don't have a strong standout contender.
That's who I went with.
I go with Blackjack Mulligan because he was filled with pork juice.
He was so juiced they had to hide it under those pajamas.
Yeah, under the pajamas, yeah. No, definitely Hogan.
All right. And final grade, on the solid end, not the best Science Man event. I don't think, I went 7 for the last couple, which I thought were some of the best ones we've seen. I went with a 5.5 on this one. I think I know those matches were hot and the stories were hot and that was the point, but we really only had one solid in-ring match, and these last couple that have kind of tipped up to that seven area were ones that had more than one or a match that really popped. Like, maybe it's just me being a little low on Hogan Orndorff, but like, I think of Savage Jake. Like, I much prefer that match to this one. So again, a really good show, but I feel like there's as much meat on this, and it's not their fault. I mean, they were really using it to lay the groundwork for Mania. So it was a smart usage of the show, but just, I thought it was a step behind some of the best ones we've seen so far.
Yeah, I mean, the last couple of Science main events have been really good top to bottom. This was very top heavy.
And even the May, I had 6.5. So, I mean, I thought the 86 was, and March. So I thought I went 6.5, 6.5, 7.7 for all of 86. So,
yeah, I mean, I did 6.5, 7, 6.5, 7.
You know, I'll go 6 on this. I'll go 6. I think it's at least as good as the January 86 one, so.
Yeah, I mean, the first two matches are really, really good. I mean, not really good. I mean, the first match is awesome, and the second match, even though it's George Steele, at least the story behind it with Steamboat and everything was fantastic. So I'll give this a 6-2. And honestly, other than besides the Blackjack Mulligan crap, the other four matches all were very important and necessary for future developments. So they all were needed, and they all served their purpose. And I still love Savage calling Mean Gene a jughead. I think this was one of my favorite moments of the night. 6.5 for me, Kel.
Well, I've overrated everything tonight, so I'll overrate this too.
12.
This was.
10.
This was. I didn't even hear it though.
I said 12 out of 10.
Oh, 12 out of 10. No, 15 out of 10 actually. This was, you know, of all the things I've had to watch for this show, this was my favorite, I think. I mean, it was super entertaining. Great all-time classic match to start. Very entertaining segment match, whatever you want to call it, with Savage, Steel, and Steamboat. And the other matches that built towards Mania were well done. I loved Vince and Jesse on commentary all night. It was refreshing to get this instead of a MSG show. So my top grade previously was 7, so I'll go 7.5 to put it above that show.
There you go.
Heady territory.
Wow.
Maybe you should watch more of these more often, Kelly.
Yeah.
You can normalize your grade. All right. So that brings an end to a very long night. We covered a lot of ground. We'll be back next week looking at the January 87 house show. Kelly will not be with us. He'll be celebrating Canadian Thanksgiving, where they eat turkey. What do you eat for that thing?
Ham. Turkey.
Yeah. Goose.
Now it's Christmas.
Gizzard.
Christmas goose. All right. Well, you have a great holiday, Kelly. We'll miss you. Talk to you in a few weeks' time. Joining us, making his, I guess, proper Blaze TV podcast debut. He's been on before, but only in the Christmas special. He's never actually joined us for a discussion of any sort when he's not reading Christmas monologues, and that is our good buddy Tim Capel. He's been a fan of the show for a long time. We go way back on the old CWO blog, so really good friends, and looking forward to having Tim here making his formal debut, breaking down the January 87 MSG. From there, the schedule gets a little spotty. We're probably going to be off the week after that, got some work stuff in the way, but we'll update you at the end of next week with our schedule forthcoming. As you know, October usually kind of a tricky month for us here on the show. So with that all said, be sure to check out the Greatest Dirty Wrestler Ever project. You can find out information on that just reaching out to us on social media. Twitter, Place Number 2 B Nation, facebook.com/Place2B Nation, Tumblr, Instagram. Just reach out to us. We'll give you all the details you need. Subscribe to our feeds on iTunes, Place2B Nation Wrestling, Place2B Nation Pop, Pro Wrestling Only. Tons of shows for you each and every day, each and every week, each and every month. Lots of great high-quality podcasts, completely free. Of course, you can help us out by going to PlaceTobeNation.com/Amazon to do all of your shopping. Nothing else you have to do. Just go to that link when you're shopping online, and we get a little bit of kickback. Download our free ebooks, Scott and I's Vintage Vaults. You can click that on the right-hand side of the site. So, Kelly, have a great holiday. We'll talk to you in a few weeks. Scott, we're out. We'll talk to you next week. Everyone, take care. Enjoy your ham, Kelly.
Wolf.
One more time to kill the pain. I feel so
never slow down, you never grow old. I'm tired of screwing up, I'm tired of going down, I'm tired of myself, I'm tired of this town. Oh my, my, oh hell yes, honey, put on that party dress. Buy me a drink, sing me a song, take me as I come, cause I can't stay long. Last dance with Mary Jane, one more time to kill the pain. Summer creeping in, I'm tired of this town again. Square, she's standing in her underwear, looking down from a hotel room, and nightfall will be coming soon.